Welcome, everyone. Senate and House joint hearing will come to order. I guess it's the Senate Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources Budget Division and the House Energy, Finance, and Policy Division. And welcome. I really appreciate this great turnout of legislators today and of the public. And it looks like we're going to fill up this room. So we have a long agenda today and a really important discussion. I know there's a lot of interest in this. So we will try to keep things moving along and stay to our time. We're scheduled to be done at 1 o'clock. Of course, we're starting a few minutes late. So we'll do our best to stay on schedule. So without further ado, we'll welcome our panel from the Office of Energy Security. Who would like to go first? Director Glahn?
Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Chairman Hilty, Senators, Representatives, staff, people. We appreciate you inviting us here this morning to give you an update on the stimulus, the ARRA fund. As I was mentioning to Chairman Hilty on my way in this here, that I have this powerful feeling of deja vu. But the good news is it's about 30 degrees cooler in here this week than it was last Friday. So my thanks to the House staff for having that happen. With me here, I have Janet Streff and Jeremy DeFebri from my office, who will be doing the bulk of the presentation here this morning. We hope to be brief. I know you have many, many questions and many, many speakers on the agenda here, so we will try to get through this as quickly and completely as possible. I also have behind me a number of other staff people who will be available if there are very specific questions dealing with implementation of projects or disposition of certain funds. So with that, I just wanted to mention a couple of things. Even though we've had this 9-month gestation period for the program, and in some ways it's still early days yet for the stimulus funds flowing from the federal government through to the state, we have some success stories we'd like to share with you this morning. We also have a number of challenges that we'll describe in implementing these programs going forward, and I'm sure we'll have some discussion of the obstacles and barriers we've encountered along the way. But with that, I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Streff for the balance of our program.
Great, thank you. And members, I just want to point out that in front of each of you, you will have a copy of the accountability and transparency reporting language from Senate File 657, which was our bill to appropriate the Recovery Act dollars. And so this is really the reason for having this hearing, to collect that report, even though we're a little past the deadline. And so we're anxious to hear results. Director Glahn.
Madam Chair, I did neglect to mention we did have a couple of handouts today. We have this handout, which appears more blue in color than others. This exercise in clarity is our federal reporting. And we have another handout, a spreadsheet that appears more orange for Halloween in color. And it's the reporting that we do to the state's NMB operation, which I think is somewhat more useful in explaining where the dollars have gone. I neglected to mention that at the beginning. Sorry.
That's fine. Thank you very much. Welcome, Ms. Streff.
Thank you, Senator Anderson. My name is Janet Streff. I manage the State Energy Office in the Office of Energy Security. And I will be sharing the presentation with Mr. DeFebri. I will say I'm very sorry I did not get the full names of the committees on this PowerPoint. Jeremy just whispered that it was 8 months, so I guess it isn't even a delivery yet, actually. But looking back, there have been milestones, most definitely. February 17th was one that I think we were all waiting for, and certainly we had even talked in January about what might happen and what kind of funds the state may receive for energy projects. It wasn't until May that the Senate File 657 was signed, and starting in March through actually September, we have received various approvals and grant contracts and notice of financial awards, and then notice of special conditions being put on them, and understanding that to get those special conditions removed required much work, hundreds of hours actually, to get these special conditions removed for prevailing wage, the National Environmental Protection Act, SHPO, which had been new to me, the State Historical Preservation Office. So these were all areas that I must say that in February we weren't nearly as well familiar with as we are now. So that was July through September that we did that. We also at that time almost doubled our staff to start to do the work. We needed to leave space. We did in our first report September 1st, and I think you've all got a copy of that, and it is on our website if you haven't, but we did, I think, go into a fair amount of detail about what we were planning to do as far as space and hiring, so I won't go into that. You know, this it culminated with our first required report to the feds through federalreporting.gov for the quarter ending, or the time period ending September 30th. It again was a difference in that typically when our quarter ends, we have another month to get the information from our subgrantees, put it into the right format, and give it to the U.S. Department of Energy. Here, for the federalreporting.gov, everybody is required to get all of their data in by the 10th of the month after that quarter ends. So we were successful. I think we actually submitted it October 8th. It was approved, and we've moved on. Bill mentioned that we handed out a couple of reports, and I know a couple of you had asked, well, send us the reports that you did for the feds, and actually it will be on recovery.gov. I think there are some initial numbers there now that my staff told me this morning are not correct, and so I think we'll be seeing that again. They'll be working on their first report to make sure that the numbers are correct. But this is not the full report. This is a representation of the components that we have to submit information on. And then this one is a larger representation, but it's not the full report of the project report that we need to submit to MMB. And we work very closely with Minnesota Management and Budget to ensure that we were collecting the information in the way that the federal government asked us to. As a result, as of September 30th, we had spent $5,037,163. This was actually all weatherization money. We at that point had not spent any money for SEP or the block grant, and Jeremy will be going into more detail about that. Suffice to say, special conditions are a great deal of it. And using the formula that the Office of Management and Budget finally came up with, we calculated that we have created or retained 169.5 jobs in the state. If you look at this in terms of our initial guidance from U.S. Department of Energy that said, please estimate it at one job per $92,000 spent, actually we're doing pretty well. I'd be dividing those numbers. I think we came up with 54.75 jobs created or retained. So this 169 was developed by actually tracking the number of hours that employees spent and really counting a full-time position when it actually became a full-time position. So somebody who was working half-time was not counted as a full job. So that was looking back. Looking forward, because of all of these special conditions and the work that we've spent in trying to get them resolved. We have also time to be laying the groundwork so that when those were, we would be ready to go. This slide just shows the RFP and contract status that we've done to date. As you can see, we've got RFPs that are almost ready to go, waiting upon some of the final information that we received regarding the National Environmental Protection Act. And so we are really forecasting a huge jump in getting some of the work out once we get that done. And we are very close. I know that we've got a conference call for 1 p.m. this afternoon to try and get one element. So we hope we'll be finished as well. So I could speed up. We wanted to give you some sense of the timeline to remind us of when things happened, and I'm not going to go through each one of these. Suffice it to say that, you know, March 26th, April, May, and it wasn't until July that we really received our final contract where DOE allowed us to spend the money to do any kind of weatherization. The first we could ramp up, and our agency certainly did. But then you see a 2-month jump there, and it wasn't until September 3rd that Minnesota received its wage determinations for weatherization workers. And as I had outlined in the September 1st report, that has been a huge barrier to understanding what kind of employees there needed to be and how much they could be paid and how that whole system would work. So, and then September 30th, 27 days later, was the end of our first reporting period. As I said, we have been busy. Our agencies have been busy. From July to October, we've divided it up into the ERA jobs that were completed, and this is absolutely final inspection. The work is all done, 643. However, there are audits in progress. It typically can take up to 90 days for a weatherization project to get completed. That's how much we actually allow them. So we wanted to give you a sense of what other work is going on. So 1,642 are in progress as of some of the numbers we got yesterday. So we are figuring 2,210. But the agencies that weren't quite sure about the Davis Bacon, we had regular U.S. Department of Energy weatherization funds. And so they have already reported 832 jobs completed with regular DOE funding. So 3,000 jobs. Just as a comparison, in 2008, using all of the money that we had, we did weatherize 4,000 homes totally. So I do think the ramp up is successful. We are on our way, and to just be wild, our next report. Again, another way to put it, in expenditures of funds, we are spending the money. The $5 million that we reported the end of September in fedreporting.gov, our projected numbers for ERA is up to past $7 million, so that's another $2 million that we spent in the month of October. So you can see in comparison the amounts of funding that we spent in 2008. I'm going to let my friend, Mr. DeFebre, take it from here.
All right, thank you. Why don't we finish Mr. DeFebre, and then we'll take questions. Mr. DeFebre, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I didn't mean finish off, Mr. DeFebre. Let you give your presentation.
Thank you for that clarification, Madam Chair. I will not bolt. I should say I will, as always, keep my remarks brief. I am going to address some of the issues and activities related to the State Energy Program and the Energy Efficiency and Conservation Block Grant funds that we received. both of which roll off the tongue very nicely as FEPECBG. And if you can say that quickly five times in a row, you actually pass the sobriety test. I do not need to go through the entire timeline. I would just like to point out a couple of items related to the timeline. We initially received our main FEP grant authorization in the end of June. However, that authorization was conditioned on further determinations under the National Environmental Policy Act. And we were actually only allowed to spend money in activities related to residential energy efficiency and some of the support activities such as data training, administration, and utility program coordination. So we responded to those restrictions prior to when DOE actually issued any guidance on how to do it, because it took them quite some time to provide us with that information. We are still working with DOE, and our 1 o'clock conference call is, we hope, the last piece in resolving some of the issues related to getting categorical exclusions under NEPA for a variety of our activities so that they can say to go forth and do good with funds in the restricted areas. In the meantime, we have begun activities that we believe are either not restricted or are under a timeline such that by the time our restrictions are lifted, we believe that that the activity will be teed up and ready to go. And I'd like to just mention a few of those. We have the Project Re-Energize through BAM. That was a $3 million contract. The project began October 1st. We have RFPs out on the street for our residential outreach activities, low-income training, and for the Emerging Renewable Industries grant.
Wait, could you just say that again? Which ones are out? Lisa, is that written down?
It's the last three items on the list. That's actually an eyesight test, too. The residential outreach, low-income training, and the emerging renewables. And although we may bring up later, the emerging renewables is going to be subject to an amendment because the Fed recently notified us of a new concern of theirs that had not been raised before. Be that as it may, we will address that. Our planned November activities. We are working with the Housing Finance Agency to launch the residential rebates in conjunction with their fix-up funds. We are working on getting out the local government building energy efficiency cost-share grants. We are in the final stages of negotiating contracts with the Port Authority for their Trillion BTU program. We are going to be releasing the 60% competitive portion of EECBG. We are also going to be releasing the $4.35 million that was authorized to us for commercial, industrial, and nonprofit energy efficiency and weatherization activities, the Duluth Innovative Residential Program Grant, and the Chicago Biomass Study Grant. Those are all planned for November. I'm not quite sure what we're going to do in December at this point, but we'll think of something, I think. That said, one of the reasons why you see this movement like that has been barriers. And the barriers essentially can be summarized as NEPA, 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 and historic preservation. National Environmental Policy Act requires DOE on any award or action that they take to determine whether there's going to be an adverse environmental impact, whether an activity can be categorically excluded from an environmental review, whether it has to have an environmental assessment or an environmental impact statement. And in our SEP plan, as I said, all but our residential activities and some of the support activities were conditioned on further review of NEPA compliance. We have been working with our national associations, with DOE, and with others to define what parameters DOE thinks programs can move forward on. We received some draft guidance towards the end of August. We have responded a number of times with proposals. Most recently, earlier this week, we have a conference call later today that we hope may nail down the final part of that agreement. I'll address a little bit more later on that, but I did want to mention historic preservation, which is less a barrier than I think an unexpected both cost and administrative step that is going to be required, and it probably is most significant in the weatherization program. The DOE under historic preservation requirements is telling us that any structure that we propose modifications to that is 50 years old or older, and therefore potentially listable on the historic register, has to have a state historic preservation office review and sign off before we can proceed.
You mean like my house?
Like your house, for instance, or my house, or the neighbor's 57 Rambler that was built.
Wow.
My personal opinion is that anything that I could have seen built in my lifetime should not be considered of historic value. But they have not agreed with that, Madam Chair.
Wow.
And again, with weatherization, if we're looking at 17,000 to 20,000 homes, we anticipate that approximately 75% of them may fall within that 50-year or older range. That gets us into more than 10,000 individual reviews. Now, many of them are going to be cursory, but they still have to be done. Look at documentation on what's going to be done. Perhaps look at documentation or photographs on the structure and say, yeah, I don't think anybody's going to be concerned about weatherizing that one. Check it off. Those many actions, our State Historical Preservation Office, with their, three or four staff, probably are not going to be able to do in a timely manner. We are looking at either contracting for or hiring a full-time person simply to address that. And that is an entirely unanticipated administrative action and time impediment and cost that really wasn't raised until September, I believe it was, by the Fed. Back to NEPA, as I said, we are working on releasing conditions on public buildings, energy efficiency activities, renewables in all sectors, and activities in commercial and industrial. However, in order to do that, DOE is requiring some restrictions on scale in order to grant categorical exclusions from further NEPA review. And that, in particular, affects what we can do under renewables and ground source heat pumps. They have given us guidelines for wind installations that anything, actually their guideline is 20 kW and under. The last point that we're trying to nail down with them is a 40 kW and under restriction instead, so that it conforms with our net metering law and allows more of typical installations that we see. They have, while initially having given us guidance that was for ground source heat pumps, 10 ton without any other limitation, they have now decided that the limitation is 5.5 tons horizontal closed loop. With solar PV, it is, if it's ground mounted, 60 kW is the max. So particularly, I think, on some of the SolarCity's grant activities as planned, that may be an impediment. Now, this doesn't mean you can't do these things per se. What it means is that DOE needs to look at each of those individual projects and determine whether they can be approved, whether they need to go to an environmental assessment, or whether they need to go to an environmental impact statement. And DOE and DOE alone does that. They will not allow that responsibility to, they say they can't allow that responsibility to be devolved to another entity. Therefore, they're anticipating that anything that requires an EA is going to have a 4 to 6 month delay. And an EA may determine that you need an EIS. So we are looking at these restrictions, trying to figure out how we can craft programs, both essentially dividing programs so that we have offerings that meet their categorical exclusion requirements, and then what areas do we think we have activities that are going to be of a small enough scale that there is a likelihood that we can get DOE to do some sort of review in a timely manner, because we're not the only ones that are going to be putting these sorts of things before them. There are 50 states and six territories that will also be doing that. So the multiple of actions that they need to take tends to get to be unworkable. That said, I believe I was brief this time, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, if I might continue with the appliance rebate program. This program was not part of Senate File 657. However, it did come down to us as a formula grant, and so we are eligible to receive just over $5 million to develop an appliance rebate program. We submitted our program plan to DOE on time, October 15th. They are telling us that they plan to get all funds out to the states and territories by the end of November. We have also been working on an RFP for a processor for these rebates. Right now, we believe that the program launch will be in the spring, March, hopefully, of 2010. It hinges a bit on the start of some of our utility programs, because we have been working closely with them to make sure that the rebates work with them. Also, many of our utilities with the new SIP programs that they're starting for 2010 are including recycling programs, and so we want to make sure that those programs have started so that when these appliance rebates are given, that we can also recycle those appliances and take them fully off the grid. At this point, we are anticipating that it will be white goods, so refrigerators, clothes washers, dishwashers, and freezers through Minnesota retailers. We believe there'll be somewhere between 25,000 and 30,000 rebates. Our administrative costs are estimated at about $400,000, and this is the only program that we are required to have a cost share of 50% for the administration only, which is another reason that we've been working closely with not only with our Minnesota retailers who may be helping with administration or rebates, but also utilities and the other stakeholders, that we can count all of that as in-kind administration. This requirement for a cost share came because this program was instituted as part of the Energy Policy Act that was passed in 2005, I believe, and had never been, no money had been appropriated. And so this was part of the law to have this cost share. Otherwise, typically, ERA has not had cost share. So households will be limited to one appliance rebate. And that's how we anticipate the distribution of funds as we move forward for that. And those are the end of our comments.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Jeff. I'm sure there's a lot of questions, so I'm just going to start off with a couple and then open it up for the committee. You know, first of all, we have our law in front of us, and this is very helpful information, and it's a really great start to the information that we were looking for. But there's some information that you didn't mention, and so I just want to ask about that. And the federal law says that the recovery dollars that we were allocating were for two main purposes. One was job creation, one was energy savings or creation, demand reduction through renewables. And I didn't hear anything about the energy savings and maybe you don't have a lot of data yet, but the weatherization program. It sounds like that's where any of the money that's been spent has been spent on weatherization, and everything else is sort of just going out the door. So that's one question. As you know, we put a lot of detail into our law, and we spent a lot of time debating that and focusing on the need to make sure that the jobs that were available were widely offered to communities, especially in need of jobs, to disadvantaged communities, to communities with high rates of unemployment, low-income rural tribal communities, communities of color. And we also had some detailed information we wanted about how many units were being weatherized and what the energy savings data is. In terms of training, it's way too early because there's an RFP just out the door. But I guess I'll just highlight those two areas as being very important to the legislature. And I want to start there.
Certainly, Madam Chair. As far as energy savings go, it is true that the U.S. Department of Energy is asking us to tack energy savings, and we certainly will. The first money was solely for weatherization. They do give us a formula to use for energy savings, although we are certainly working with our utilities to find a way to better track that so they can receive those energy savings as well. But at this point, it's too early to start reporting on those energy savings. We because we have that formula, we could give you a number based on the number that we've done. That would not be a problem.
A number? What do you mean?
We are given a formula for energy savings that DOE says to use as we report the number of houses done. It's based on the savings to investment ratio so that we do things that are cost effective and that save energy. And so we could use that formula as well. As I mentioned, we are also working in-state to find better ways to actually track the actual energy savings. It's a larger project, and we've just started to figure out how to evaluate that using some of the data that we have through our LIHEAP program and then those that go into the weatherization program but may still stay in the LIHEAP program.
Well, okay, in terms of reporting cost effectiveness, that you're talking about telling us what the target is, which would be great, but we want to know if you're actually meeting those targets. That's the point of accountability information, is to know if you're actually getting that done. And I know some of that is determined up front as part of the weather, you know, home by home, there is an evaluation of what would be cost effective. So maybe that some of that data would be available at the front end. But we want more detailed information at the back end as well. And if you don't have it yet, I just want to make sure that during the process of weatherizing these homes, that data is being collected. And maybe it hasn't been collected specifically in previous years from the weatherization program, but that's the intention of these dollars, is to make sure that there's a lot of transparency, and that we want results for this recovery money, and that's a really important part of it.
Jeremy seems to be itching.
Go ahead, please. Be brave.
I don't know whether it's itching. It may be burning. Madam Chair, as you said, we calculate anticipated energy savings or return on investment prior to making any improvements in the home, and it has to meet the savings to investment ratio standard that DOE sets. Those are the numbers that we could report today, and while they may be of some use, the numbers you are looking for are not going to be available until you have a history of energy use post-implementation.
And do you have a plan? Is anyone measuring that so we can get that information?
Madam Chair, as Ms. Straff mentioned, we are looking at both the data resources we have through EHEAT, working with both our local weatherization agencies and our weatherization staff to put together a protocol for a reasonable sampling of homes to come up with a valid number on average energy savings.
What about for example the blower door test that's done? Usually that's done at the beginning of in the audit process, and then it's done as a follow up. Would you have that data for each home that's been weatherized?
Madam Chair, yes, that is done with each weatherization, so we can tell you how much tighter the house is. That may or may not translate into the same amount of energy savings, depending on how the house is used after that. But yes, we could certainly report back to you on those elements.
That would be really helpful.
Madam Chair?
Yeah, just a moment. Oh, well, on this point?
Yeah.
Well, who's talking?
Representative Norton.
Okay. I'm sorry. And I just had one more question. So did you want to, on this point,
this is on the same subject, and I just had, I guess, sort of a comment or question.
I know I have several questions waiting.
But I didn't want to interrupt you, but I needed to clarify when you're talking about cost savings, how you would actually arrive at that with the unpredictability of fuel costs. And this year, for example, fuel costs are way down. So how do you calculate savings in energy when you have such a fluctuation in that basic input cost? So I'm just saying, in defense of the witnesses, I think you've got a real challenge on your hands to come up with the numbers that we're asking for.
Well, I think, Representative Nornis, I think when we said energy savings, you can define that as two things. What I'm focusing on is how much less natural gas are you going to use, or how much less electricity are you going to use, not how much it's going to cost you. I mean, I think we actually want both of those. And I think if you read the language, my assumption was, intention was, is that it would cover both of those questions. Now, if you're not reading the law that way, please let us know. But I think we need to know how much actual energy usage. Well, then there's the third question, how much the homeowner, their personal, their energy habits, whether those change or not, of course, is a factor. But we'd really like information on how much energy reduction there is in addition to what the cost number is. So is that possible to get both of those?
Madam Chair, certainly we have numbers on both of those, and we'd be more than happy to work with you and your staff to make sure that we're tailoring the questions and the requirements that we ask of our weatherization agencies so that we're getting you the information that you are truly wanting.
All right, and I'm sure there'll be some follow-up on this, but let me just ask one more question, and then I'll call on some other folks. The issue of hiring and jobs, and I know we've had a lot of discussion over the last couple of months about this as the RFPs went out for weatherization programs. We have heard some concerns about the requirement to use apprenticeships and similar programs whenever possible, and we specifically require in this language as well to reach out to disadvantaged communities. Is that, just tell us how that's being done, please.
Madam Chair, agencies and groups of agencies are doing it in different manners, and I guess I would also ask you to get more detailed information from some of the other agencies that are testifying. However, all have been quite aware of that component and have been working with different attorneys and groups to make sure that the procurement procedures that they're using are in accordance with this law and others.
All right. Well, we will certainly ask them that question, but the law requires you to report on it, and so that would, to me, assume that you would tell the folks that are getting federal money that they have to provide that information. And I would have presumed that would be a requirement that they provide that to you. Is it not? Are you requiring them to give you that information? And are you talking about in the, which item number, Madam Chair, on the accountability are you highlighting, I guess? Right now I'm focusing on paragraph 3, the number of jobs retained or created, and you mentioned that, but data on hiring from communities, and it references targeted communities. Those experiencing high rates of unemployment, including but not limited to low-income rural tribal communities and communities of color. There's some other language in the bill that talks about outreach for those jobs and trying to recruit applicants for those jobs from disadvantaged communities or communities facing high rates of unemployment, et cetera. So all of those kinds of requirements, I'm wondering if you're requiring grantees to give you that information. Are we just sort of leaving it up to them to follow the law?
Madam Chair, certainly Chapter 138 that was passed is part of the contracts that we and grants that we are requiring of our it's in the language for our grants and contracts. So yes, they will be. I guess I should apologize. The report that we gave you on September 1st was before we had any data, and I did not take this hearing to be another full report of that kind, and so certainly January 15th is when we will be making sure that as a written report, we have polled those who we have contacts with to make sure that they are giving us all of this data that's in this accountability and transparency. So my apologies, I did not come to this hearing with that intent.
Well, Ms. Treff, I'm a little disappointed, and we haven't talked about this personally, but my assumption was, because this was preliminary reports and we started talking with your agency about having a hearing back in August, and because you didn't have anything except preliminary, you didn't have enough information, that's why we're doing this hearing on almost the last day of October, 2 months later, because we wanted to give you enough time to give us some of these results. So I thought that was very clear. All right, let me call on some others. Representative Thielen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I want to thank Commissioner Glahn and Mr. DeFebvre and Ms. Druff for the work that you've done. I know it's traditionally been one of the smallest offices in our state government, and have been given a task that is an exponential growth in many, many programs, and ramping up staff quickly. And I just want to recognize the effort that you have taken, and that effort has been made complicated by the fact that the probably least engaged federal department over the last 2.5 or 3 decades, the Department of Energy, has now been asked to take a leading role in job creation and energy programs in areas where, frankly, their own assistant secretary for efficiency and renewables 2 years ago called their record absolutely abysmal in a GAO report. So the ramp-up has been an incredible challenge. You guys are diving in headfirst, grabbing qualified people to dive in headfirst with you as well. I want to get to the barriers in a second, first, as the House author of Chapter 138, Senate File 657, I do think that the goal of, my intent of the goal of these initial reports, especially the first one, as we talked about, was to identify the barriers that you're experiencing and ways that we as a legislature can partner with you in the executive branch to remove those barriers. I know the barriers have been many. and Mr. Zebri and I have talked about them individually, and continue to want to offer what we can do to help remove those barriers. I do hope that the next report, that what we can do is, because the data is there, and I think to the question that Senator Anderson was asking, that if we can, if the data is available, if you could actually provide for us just a response to the items on the list in that kind of summary when we have our next report, I think that'll be very helpful for us to be able to just click through it, because the data is there, and it certainly will be robust by the time that we turn the calendar year. I want to highlight what my understanding of number four, the calculated versus actual energy savings, has been, and I think Representative Noinas is getting at this a little bit, that as we know in the energy efficiency world, that we project and calculate savings, and the actual savings are different. Sometimes they're more robust, sometimes they're a little bit leaner because of variables that we just don't know, because people actually occupy buildings. We actually use buildings. Sometimes we're smarter than we think we will be, and sometimes there are refrigerators that stay plugged in even though they're empty. So I hope that when we get to January 15th that we have a sense from weatherization. Obviously, we don't need to know every single home, but if we can get a sense of what projected savings are going to be on the average homes, as well as then what are utility bills, what are actual consumption, weather, you know, normalized for weather looking like. And then, of course, on the larger projects of larger buildings and, say, the trillion BTU project with Xcel and the Port Authority, we want to know, are we succeeding? Are we meeting what we think should happen? Are there things that we're learning for the long term? One other just quick comment, and then I want to have an opportunity just to chat very quickly about the federal delay and what we can do to move things along. On the apprenticeship language, I think that there, I know we'll hear from other folks, I just want to go on record to say that I think the first chapter of this long story of the great opportunity of economic recovery through retrofit, and you all should have in your packets a one-pager from the White House Council on Environmental Quality, it's looking long-term at the job opportunities through energy efficiency, but we have a long, long book to write. I think the first chapter of the story, unfortunately, is a little bit of a missed opportunity from the weatherization providers, from the CAPS, from OES, and from labor. I don't think it's too late to capitalize on that opportunity, but we missed it on the first chapter. Let's make sure the next chapters are not a story of missed opportunity, but a story of real capitalization of getting the next generation of workers in and trained cost effectively, very skillful. Let's get them out there and get them, put them to work. Those are my comments. The question that I have, I think, for Mr. DeFebri, who I think has probably spent the most time banging his head against the NEPA wall. We had talked early on about the Fed's decision to find a way to deliver stimulus dollars as quickly as possible with the fewest headaches. I think the phrase that got bantered about is that they might have chosen, they were trying to choose the least inefficient way of doing it. What's been driving that National Environmental Policy Act trigger from your experience, and is there something that we can do to help expedite removing that last barrier?
Mr. DeFebri?
Madam Chair, Representative Kalin, I have been banging my head against that wall. I've probably easily put in 200, 250 hours dealing with NEPA over the past 4 months. As you said, the Congress and the administration were attempting to choose the least inefficient approach to delivering funds. That does not necessarily lead to an efficient approach. They chose programs that were existing because otherwise federal departments would have to go through rulemaking process, which is excruciating, would be a kind word, I think. However, they did not anticipate, I think, in the ARA, all of the potential barriers that, that might be raised to delivering these programs in what anybody would perceive as an efficient manner. NEPA was one that I think, from the state's perspective, we have operated the SEP program and its predecessor for 30 years and operated many programs similar to what we proposed and had no NEPA issues. And it's puzzled us somewhat why, at a time that that we're supposed to be getting funds out expeditiously, we are getting what is a far more rigorous NEPA review from DOE. We finally got what I think is a rational answer, if not one that we necessarily accept, in that FEP for many years had been a $35 to $50 million a year program, and it became, what, a $2 billion program?
Nationally,
yes, and it had been $35 to $50 million nationally. DOE NEPA compliance folks do essentially a resource and risk assessment of if you're taking $50 million in programming it out there, how much harm can you do versus what resources they have to apply to the universe of things that they might be having grant actions or direct actions on. When you get to $2 billion, all of a sudden the risk assessment says you could do considerably more harm. So that's why they're taking a closer look.
Madam Chair, Mr. DeFebre, thank you. I appreciate that, the sort of caution of making sure that first do no harm. And I think we are in uncharted territory here in the sense that for instance, in late December, when the capital markets were at kind of 0 degrees Kelvin, when nothing else was moving, nobody could get any money, because the cost effectiveness and the rate and the return on investment of energy efficiency, those energy efficiency bonds could be sold even then. In fact, some of us were downtown at Piper Jaffray, who had gone from like the 11th largest investment banking company in the world to 4, because everyone else had dropped. And the market had so quickly changed, the stimulus was responding to that, but we're in this new world where the folks who in this room and others who've been trudging through energy efficiency for years and not getting any attention because it makes sense on paper, but there's no wind turbine, there's no solar panel to look at, that now we're actually delivering on a big scale and we're putting people to work. It's a challenge, but I know that three of us, Senator Anderson, Representative Knuth, and I actually met with Nancy Sutley, the chair of the Council on Environmental Quality, who's responsible for safeguarding NEPA, and whatever we can do, I want to just reiterate this again, whatever we can do to bark up the tree to say, let's not punish Minnesota, where we've resolved a lot of these questions, for instance, on ground source heat pumps, and had this debate for 10 or 15 years, and where we have a strong history of historic preservation, we're not exactly going to do ridiculous things to our fine historic buildings. We need to make sure that we are working together to clear the deck as fast as we can. It's just absolutely critical. One last question I have, Madam Chair, and I know that other people have important questions as well. Number 6 on our accountability reporting is talking about non-stimulus dollars leveraged for each project, and I think then obviously aggregating the leverage as a whole. The Recovery Through Retrofit announcement is really focused on unlocking private capital and using the stimulus as a means of doing that. We've talked about, although I know it's a competitive stimulus grant, but the energy efficiency, the ECBG competitive grant, the National Energy Efficiency Center application. I'm wondering if you could just talk briefly about that leveraging piece so far, and then what you see moving ahead, especially on the EECBG competitive grant.
Madam Chair, Representative Kalin, retrofit ramp-up, as it's called, the Energy Efficiency and Conservation Block Grant competitive grant that just was released a week or so ago, it's a $400 million grant, and they have come out and are asking for cities to states to be form partnerships within the states, to find ways to create new financing, to make an impact in a particular part of a city. Minnesota, I think, has an advantage with Minneapolis and St. Paul, and being asked to participate in what was called the Green Boot Camp back in early June, along with several state agencies in financing, energy, nonprofits. There were a group of 10 of us who went to that, and they were really asking us to look at how would we create a group that could make this happen in our city when we went back. And I would say that the team has kept together, and we're working on this already when this retrofit ramp-up program or grant application came. So I know that Minneapolis-St. Paul is right in the middle, as are we with them, helping to apply for this grant. It will be up to $75 million. We have had interest from some other metro cities, and while I haven't talked to the Minneapolis-St. Paul folks, I think that we need to look at that and see how that may apply as well. So it's exciting, and I think it does give us an opportunity. I would say that one thing that we've realized is that we have many of the elements already in place, and it's maybe looking at them a little bit differently or putting them together just a little bit differently. The elements of our SIP program are those that can be ramped up to do even more work. So it is exciting. As I would like to mention another large grant that we participated with DEED in applying for, and that was the U.S. Department of Labor State Energy Sector Partnership Grant. It's a grant that will receive up from anywhere from $2 to $6 million. And it mirrors in many respects the requirements that were laid out in your legislation for us to create a training plan and procedures. And so we have been waiting to see how much we would get for that, to hopefully use some of that money to do it so we could use some of the money that was allocated for that plan and procedures to more training or to more energy efficiency and renewable energy. Again, it's been a very successful partnership. It does have one area that that I think may be an area where we might be able to use it for a national energy efficiency training center or the technology transfer center, and that is, we're just beginning to think about that, but I think that might be an area where we can make that a reality as well.
Did you want to say something, Mr. DeFever, on that? Okay. Just a question to follow up on the historic preservation piece of it. If we were to change, could we do something at the state level to fix that, because it's a state law? I mean, if we, in February, could we tweak our law, and then that would get the feds off our back on that particular issue?
Madam Chair, it's not a state law. It's
okay.
Section 106 of something federal. I'm sorry, I don't remember the citation. There's Section 1512, Section 106, and they are saying that actually the federal agency is supposed to, they are able to devolve, I think, the authority down to the state to do that. So we have met with our SIPO office, and I think that we do have a good plan in that they are willing to sign an agreement to allow this person who will be in our office to do the majority of sign-offs. So we're just hoping too many famous people aren't in a lot of those homes.
All right, great. Thank you. Representative Taylor?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a little question of clarification for Ms. Streff. And that's with regard to the appliance rebate program. I thought I heard you say that there was some potential barrier or problem with recycling of the old appliances, or did I mishear you? Is there something that's maybe going to hold up the show that you have concerns about with regard to disposing of the old models?
Madam Chair, Representative Taylor, it's not truly a barrier. It's a timing in that Many of our smaller utilities, munis and co-ops are starting recycling programs throughout the state, and those programs start January 1st, 2010. And so we've been approving the plan so that they can get them in place. But we do want to make sure that those programs are up and running, that those utilities have an opportunity to get them in place so that we don't have an issue when somebody in a certain area wants to recycle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a follow-up on that. When you use the word recycling, are you talking about the programs within the energy companies where they'll kind of do a take-back, or are you talking about the actual disposal recycling that has to do with the counties?
Madam Chair,
Ms. Jeff,
Representative Saylor, that's detailed enough to let me have Mr. Jeff Hawes, who runs our SIP program, who's been working with the utilities, answer that question.
Welcome to the committee. Mr. Hawes?
Yes, that's right. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Madam Chair, Representative Saylor, the utilities have been contracting and have done programs in the past where they contract with a specific recycler to recycle the appliance fully. And what we've been working with, we want to provide as many options for customers as possible through this program so that if there are recycling options, opportunities through a retailer or through a utility or through a solid waste administrator, that those are clearly delineated and made available. There are obviously pros and cons to each type. If you go through the retailer, the pro being you don't really have a lot of headache or hassle having to set up a number of appointments. If you're going through a utility, you have the opportunity to recover a bounty for that. And the bounties have been, $35 to $50 in the past, and that's what it appears to be going forward. And we want to make sure that the program is flexible enough that it allows those various options, because not everyone in the state is going to have an opportunity to recycle through their retailer or their utilities, and retailers treat these programs differently from one to another. So we're just approaching it from the standpoint of trying to provide as many options and making those as clear as possible.
All right, Representative Stolberg.
Madam Chair, just back to historic preservation. Was that a problem with the original funds or the other funds before the ARRA?
Madam Chair, Representative, SHPO is the State's Historic Preservation Act is also been there.
Madam Chair, did we ignore it in the past?
DOE certainly did not highlight it or put it in our guidance. My real remembering, I do think, to the U.S. Department of Energy's credit, that they are particularly concerned at getting the money out and spent in a way that complies with all federal laws so that they do not end up on the front page of the paper.
Well, Madam Chair, I think most, just about every one of our homes would probably qualify for that.
Well,
I didn't know
ones,
I was in a historic home.
Especially the ones we want to weatherize, right. It's a little broad of a net, I would say. And a lot of the ones that need weatherization probably are not historic monuments. Senator Vickerman.
Well, Madam Chair, I notice on number 8 of this, the accountability list veterans.
Mm-hmm.
I want to hear more from you, not just veterans, anybody can say that word. I want to know what we're doing if we're helping those homes, and I don't know if we can get that done yet, but I'd certainly like that in the next report. How many veterans, homeowners, have we helped? Would that be possible?
We can sure ask. And I think this provision also relates to hiring and making sure that that the hiring practices comply with prevailing wage and veterans' preference laws about hiring and disadvantaged business enterprise requirements. So we do want to hear about that as well. Jeff?
Madam
Madam Chair, Senator, currently that information as far as whether a person in a household is a veteran is not collected in either our weatherization information, or nor do we take it on the application for our low-income heating assistance program. However, compliance with these requirements as far as hiring and that certainly are part of our contracts, and we expect our sub-grantees to follow that law.
Madam Chair?
Who said that? Sorry.
I was going to add the one thing we could explore is that in the LIHEAP program, they do collect income information, and perhaps we could see whether one can sort on households that receive VA benefits as at least a baseline for those that would clearly be veterans.
All right, thank you. Senator Bach.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and whichever one of the witnesses wants to take a shot at this, but I noticed in the report, and I want to ask this because I don't want to get a final report someday and say, well, nobody ever asked, but on page 5, where you have a Roman numeral, says barriers to implementation, Davis-Bacon, you identify that on any contract over $2,000 that prevailing wage rates apply, and then on page 5, the last three sentences of Roman numeral 4, you say that you've applied for a waiver to prevailing wage requirements. And I'd like to know what that means, because I think the legislature was pretty clear that we wanted prevailing wages to apply to these projects. And what the content of the waiver is.
Mr. DeFebre?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, we actually have chosen not to apply for that waiver. However, the problem that it was intended to address relates to the residential energy efficiency programs that have been authorized under 138. There's $7.65 million to provide assistance for energy efficiency outside of the low-income weatherization program. The issue that we were looking at with regard to those programs is we're anticipating that there are going to be 2,000 or more job sites for that program. If we provide an incentive to a homeowner directly, the homeowner is then liable for appropriate enforcement and potential penalty under the prevailing wage law. And on a more practical level, we would probably be dumping a 25-page contract on them for their $2,500 rebate. There is no way that our office administratively, without another 20 people, could appropriately enforce prevailing wage laws in 2,000 separate job sites, under 2,000 separate contracts. So we were, at that time, looking for a method of how do we deliver a residential program when those constraints apply.
Well, Madam Chair, then who is going to do the compliance and all this work if you're not? I mean, are the cap agencies that are receiving money here, and I understand the ones that are doing the work in-house, it's pretty easy. But where they're issuing contracts, who is responsible for the compliance? And is there any opportunity for somebody that thinks the law's not being followed to review some documents that have been collected someplace?
Madam Chair, Senator, we are collecting weekly payroll receipts from our weatherization agencies, since those are the ones that we have the contracts with right now. The originals will stay in our office. We will look for anomalies, and if we see any, then it's our responsibility to follow up on that. We've also met with the local Department of Labor office. They have a wage determination contracting person here, and so we certainly can call them if we see something that we think needs to be followed up.
Well,
we're talking about state and federal prevailing wage law. So the state agency would also be responsible for enforcing the state law, presumably. Is there any involvement of our state? Is it Department of Labor and Industry that is responsible for enforcing that?
We have not, Madam Chair, we have not met with them on that particular issue.
All right. I have Senator Rummel. No? You're going to pass?
I'm done.
Okay. Senator Tory Thray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I listened to the questions that the senators asked and kind of read this report, I'm kind of concerned about the fact that this report really provides really broad language on process, and I'm going to read an example of it. On page 11, Article 3, you use an entire paragraph to tell us that you had meetings, basically. You said you reviewed this information, you met, and then you said you attended meetings, and then you participated in discussions. And I think part of the dilemma for me is to look at what was stated in the legislation, and I think some of the questions you asked, Madam Chair, with respect to the information that we need about specific projects funded. It says in the legislation, Senator Bach just asked a question about prevailing wages. It is in here. Senator Vickerman just talked about veterans. It is here. Remaining balances is here. The total calculated actual energy savings, which you asked about, is here. So I think the list is very clear with respect to the outcomes that we wanted to see in this report. And I know it's really early, but, you know, and I know you probably don't have those numbers, but I just wanted to make sure that you knew that I am particularly interested, and I think that the senators that have asked these questions are particularly interested in a report that actually describes what it was said in legislation, and it says very clearly, include a complete accounting. It's clear, and I would like to see those numbers. I guess it's okay for me to have an account of the meetings that took place and know that, you know, you have done all of this work, of course, but I am more interested in the specific outcome and the accounting that is stated in the legislation of the funding that was received in very specific ways within the categories that were outlined in the legislation.
Senator Torres-Ray, and I would just echo what you said. I think I know the department has been, all the employees in the department have been working extremely hard to meet the requirements of our law, of federal law, and to get this money out the door for good purposes. But also, we just can't say enough how important it is for us as the guardians of this money to show results to the public. There's been so much discussion about this, and people are watching, and we need to be able to document that we are getting good results for this money, and that's why we put these things in the law, and that's why we're holding your feet to the fire, because we're counting on you to give us that information. We need it just, the public deserves to have this information to know that the money is being well spent. All right. I have Representative Adkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to both of you for having this hearing. On the topic of results, on the topic, like Senator Bach, of jobs, do we have a sense, you know, in terms of putting the jobs on the ground, where we stand, you know, all the various states have now reported, where are we at compared to the other states that are doing the same thing? It's kind of, right now we're sort of in a vacuum, and I appreciate your testimony very much. I'm just curious how we stack up against the other states that are doing the same thing. Are we ahead of what they're doing? Are we behind them? Are we all on the same pace?
Madam Chair, Representative, the numbers are only now starting to go on recovery.gov. It's October 30th, and I think it's actually November 1st when they said they would start posting them from the first reporting cycle. So they are still going through those. my best information is even from the Star Tribune report yesterday, in that it sounded as though some states were not were maybe reporting more jobs, but they were not reporting them correctly. And I think that that's the phase that FedReporting.gov and Recovery.gov is in right now, is making sure that that the jobs were calculated in the correct amount. So no, we have not seen any real national data come out yet, because they're still going through it.
And Representative Atkins, I just want to tell you that my experience has been talking about the work that we did in the legislature on this recovery money, and how we really spent a lot of time and got a lot of public input and really hammered out a lot of detail about how we wanted it to go. From what I've heard, is quite unique around the country, and I've talked about it at a number of national conferences, and people have, I don't think most states did that. Now, that doesn't mean they don't have state agencies or whomever is responsible doing this in great detail, but I think we may be one of the few states that actually put those requirements out in a very clear way. So hopefully that means we'll get better results, but that means we better get better results.
Well, Madam Chair, that would be my simple request, is that as we continue the conversation, I don't expect that this is a, you know, the single point in time where you're going to follow up on how this is going. But it'd be interesting to see as that data comes forward. And I'm sure, you know, as a benchmark, you folks probably want to see how other states are doing as well. It'd be nice for this committee to see that when as that data becomes available.
Well, and Representative Atkins, if you look at the law, remember it says we're supposed to get this exact type of reports. We have September, January, April, and September. We have four reporting dates in here. So we intend to follow up as well, and so I appreciate your bringing that up. Representative,
to this point, really, really briefly, thank you, Madam Chair, I appreciate your flexibility. I did a quick math exercise here of the $5,035,000 spent on the weatherization ramp up, and 169 and a half jobs, and I understand that this is not using the Fed assumption, this is using the state drilling down formula to really look at what are the jobs created, and the average cost is $29,700. I think that's a really cost-effective delivery of stimulus funds. We need to keep stretching as far as we can and leveraging the dollars we have, but $29,000 for job creation and energy savings is going to help people and help us save money in the long run. I think it's a good start. I hope that we can accurately compare to other states as well, but I wanted to share that number, and I understand that it's pretty accurate reflection.
Right. Representative Phelan, I think a lot of us did the math, and I think the question is, it is a really good number for a job created. It would be nice to know what else we got with that money, and are there other matches that counted towards what people are making? I mean, but that's a very important point, and the fact that we're on track to weatherize 75% the number of homes that we did in a whole year last year is the first benchmark I'm seeing that looks really, really strong as well. Representative Reinert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. DeFebre, I think you tried to answer this question in your presentation, but what I'd like to understand more directly are what the specific barriers are to the development of the guidelines for residential geothermal rebates. I know that in general you touched on some of that with NEPA and historic preservation, but if you could just list those for me, that would be helpful in clarifying that.
Madam Chair, Representative Breiner, the guidance that we have received from the NEPA compliance office at DOE Golden is that they will provide a categorical exclusion for any installation that is under 5.5 tons or equal to or under 5.5 tons capacity with a horizontal closed loop heat transfer field. That, while it's helpful, we are seeing a number of vertical installations, and probably the preponderance of installations that are occurring in the state right now are vertical. they are going to require a project-by-project review in order to approve any of those installations for federal funding. They will not provide categorical exclusion above those numbers, and it makes it somewhat difficult to offer a program to people that is, come and get the money, maybe, depending on what the feds say. You know, obviously, if you're drilling through showy lady slippers, you clearly have a problem. But if they have not been able to give us a very clear parameter that we can go to people and say, even though you're doing vertical, these are, you know, under these conditions, you're probably in a pretty good position.
Representative Bryan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So will the process be to have an inspector come out to every site and follow some guidelines, apply an early environmental review, or what? You don't know is what you're telling me totally, how that will play out at this point, and that's one of the things you're working on, clarifying with the federal government?
Madam Chair, Representative Reinert, that is very much one of the things I think we are trying to get better guidance from the feds so that we can then say we can put a program on the ground with these elements. But until they tell us anything other than each one of them is going to have fill out their standard environmental review questionnaire, and then they'll make a decision. You can't put a program on the ground under that. So one of the things we need to talk to them about this afternoon is, you know, give us better guidance on parameters.
Thank you. Senator Gill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to understand this historic preservation issue a little better. As I understood it, you said if a house is over 50 years old, that it's going to qualify for some of these programs, it has to be evaluated as to whether there's some historic preservation value there. And does that mean that it is not then eligible, if it does have some value for historic preservation purposes, does that mean it is not eligible for weatherization money, or how does that, explain to me how that really works?
Madam Chair, Senator, it applies to all buildings, not just homes, so it could be schoolhouses too, I guess. And it would depend on who it was and what was going to be done to the structure, because then you go into how do you keep a historic structure, and there are different guidelines for that. But it's my understanding that they will look at the address, they will find out if the home architecturally is one that is of interest historically, again, whether it's residence or somebody who had lived there was of interest, and we'll go from there. So it doesn't necessarily mean that it can't. It will depend. We presume that by far the majority of the homes are going to have a quick sign-off, and we will get to that.
But if it is an historic home, does that mean that it's not eligible, or it might be eligible depending on what's going to be done to it?
Madam Chair, Senator, that's correct. There are, for instance, windows. And while our weatherization program doesn't make a practice of changing out windows, it's not the best energy efficient method. But there are historic windows are very different from some of the new windows that are put in, and so it's those kinds of building components that they would want to look at and make sure that whatever was being done to the home or the building, the structure was not taking that away from the structure.
All right, members, I've got three more members on the list with questions, and then we really have to move on to our agenda. We got a lot of other folks to testify. So I've got Senator Hand, Senator Frederickson, Senator Rummel, and then we'll move on. Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would just like to see if I could get your comments or whether your reporting will address this. There's been some talk about energy savings in the long run, and I'm curious to know how long is the long run. In other words, if we spend $2,500 to do a weatherization project and there's energy savings generated by that, whatever the savings dollars are, offset against that cost, we'll have a payback period of so many years, whatever it might be. What is that? Is that something that you're going to tell us as well? If we spend whatever the dollars are, we'll see the energy savings produce a payback in 10 years or 50 years? Or what is the answer to that? Or is that going to be part of what you'll be reporting to us?
Mr. DeFebre.
Madam Chair and Senator Hahn. Particularly within weatherization, there is a calculation that takes into consideration the cost of the measure, the potential energy savings of the measure, a average predicted cost based on recent year history for the heating or fuel or electricity, and the anticipated useful life of a measure. So the calculation for an improvement like a window that you could anticipate probably a 20 to 30 year useful life might be different from a water heater where you would predict a much shorter useful life. Within those parameters, you have to meet a savings investment ratio where you do return greater savings than the investment requires.
Yes, that's part of the report.
Yes.
All right, thank you. Senator Fredrickson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Streff, the program that I've received the most questions about has been the appliance rebate, and on your slide you gave four appliances that would be eligible for rebates. Is that the complete list, or is that an example of which appliances would be eligible?
Madam Chair, Senator, those are the appliances that we elected to pursue in our rebate program. There are certainly HVAC, other avenues or other ways, different kinds of appliances. One of the reasons that we did that is we looked at our utility programs and the focus that they were also going to provide with their new SIP programs. And so this was an area that we believe was not reached as much through our utility programs. It also was the white goods were a program that would reach many citizens, and that was also one of our goals.
Well, Madam Chair, Ms. Jeff, I find it a little curious that you would include clothes washers but not clothes dryers.
Madam Chair, Senator, I don't believe there are any clothes dryers that are Energy Star rated.
Mr. DeFebre, did you want to add?
Madam Chair, Senator, I was just going to add, the reason for that is that
Energy Star clothesline.
Well, there are certainly, yeah, if you give them enough rope. Clothes dryers, typically the efficiency values between different clothes dryers vary very little, and the energy input is largely a function of how wet the clothes are and what the humidity of the intake air is.
Thank you.
Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yesterday at the similar hearing for health, housing, and human services, we were given an output thing about ARRA funds. And on their output, it suggests, and I'm on the topic of commercial, industrial, and small business, it suggests that Emerging Renewable Energy Industries Grant Program is now available, but in your report, it's not. So I'm trying to find out where are we and who's in the loop.
Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, I perhaps you're referring to the September 1 report. When it wasn't available, the RFP was released 2 weeks ago or something like that, and the response period is through December 18th, I believe.
And who received the RFPs?
We provided notification to everybody that had provided us an email expressing interest in stimulus programs. Plus, we posted in the State Register and on our website. And the RFP is obtained through download through our website.
And you said due December?
December 18th. We will. I alluded to earlier, there is an additional wrinkle that the feds came up with that affects that program that we need to iron out is that may create some barriers for some of the intended or some of the folks that were intending to apply, and that is that we had focused our RFP on jobs impact, economic impact within Minnesota, and the DOE is now saying that they are going to require a reasonable energy impact within the state. So an industry that, while it manufactures something in the state, sells most of its product out of the state, DOE may determine that they are not eligible for SEP funds. That's a battle that we're about to fight with them.
I appreciate it.
Thank you. All right, we want to thank you for your time, and we look forward to getting more information back just as soon as you have it. Thank you. Members, let's move on. Next on the agenda, we have Burl Haar from the Public Utilities Commission. Welcome to the committee.
Sure, thank you, and members. I really don't have any comments on the foregoing presentation. I know your focus of your other speakers here really probably is on that. So I just wanted to let the committees know that the commission has also received a grant under the Recovery Act as well. It has a different focus, and it's not nearly as large or as broad in scope, but it will allow us to add staff resources to help us with transmission planning efforts, and that's an area where there's a lot going on right now, as I'm sure you're all well aware, and it's an area where we do need some specialized expertise. And our grant is for $883,000, so it's much smaller than what you've been hearing, the numbers you've been hearing, but it will help us to add. We're hoping three transmission planning specialists, power system engineers, to help us not only with the facilities permitting processes that we have before the commission, the active dockets that we have there, but also with monitoring and participating in and helping to shape the activities that are going on with the Midwest ISO and the various regional planning initiatives, regional transmission planning initiatives. So I just wanted to make sure that you all were aware that we have that in play as well. And I do have a brief project description here. Todd, I can make those available if you'd like to add them to your packet.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hart. You've done some discussion on smart grid improvements in transmission as well, haven't you?
That certainly has been part of the conversation, absolutely. The whole process involves many moving pieces, and certainly smart grid is part of that conversation. And that's one of the areas that we're interested in gearing up for in this initiative, because of course we're anticipating a filing project coming in from Xcel and the Central Corridor project, which will involve that kind of technology. And this is another area where we're going to need to have specialized expertise to help us evaluate what's being proposed there and make sure it's in the public interest and cost-effective, et cetera. So.
And these recovery-funded positions are available for that as well, and can you tell us how long those positions will be funded for?
Right. Yeah, Madam Chair, they are available for that. They are specifically earmarked for state regulatory bodies such as ours to help us deal with the workload that's being created by the policy initiatives that are taking place that are having effects on transmission planning, on renewable energy development, on energy efficiency measures, and so on. So it's mainly focused on helping commissions deal with the extra workload, and it's very welcome. We believe it will start after the first of the year, and it would go for two years from that date. So it would overlap a couple of biennials.
Thank you, Representative Westrum.
Madam Chair, on the same topic, Mr. Hart, what? And maybe this gets a little far afield, but briefly, what is out there for smart grids? And you talked about the Central Corridor, but the other filings coming across the state, are there new types of grids or smart grids or new types of technologies or wires that transport more electricity with less capacity needed, or I mean, just what's out there that we might be looking at that these positions would fill, and that might change some of the landscape of what we've seen or known as transmission lines.
Madam Chair, Representative, I need a technical expert to help answer that question, I guess, but I can tell you that I know there's a tremendous amount of attention being given to it. I know our utilities, Minnesota utilities, are looking at it. Minnesota Power, in fact, just announced the other day they received some grant funding through ARRA, another component of it, to do some smart grid activities, and there are others as well. So it's receiving a lot of attention. A lot of the attention so far has been focused on metering, helping customers understand their power usage and control the power usage. But I do believe there are also efforts being made on transmission technology, trying to understand how to better transmit energy from one area to another, since regional interdependence has become much more pronounced with the evolution of the energy markets that we have, and therefore gaining those efficiencies is a critical feature. So yeah, there's a lot of effort being put to that, and perhaps I could come back at a later time and we could provide greater detail on that if you'd like.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Westrum, for bringing that up. I'd love to get an update on that, too, and maybe our policy committees or the Energy Commission could do that as well. Dr. Hart, do you know offhand if any of President Obama just announced the Smart Grid Recovery Grant? $3.5 billion or something went out. Do you know, or here comes Director Glahn. I forgot to ask Commerce this. Do we know if any of that money is coming to Minnesota?
Madam Chair, Representative Westrum, yes. Well, Minnesota Power did win one of the awards, and I'm at the risk of messing up the name, Sioux Valley Co-op in the far southwestern corner of the state. It's a co-op that actually serves, part of a larger co-op that serves the Sioux Falls area in South Dakota, and actually also south of the border in Iowa, and they are going to use their grant money, as I understand it, to install smart meters for all their customers. Wow. And their entire, well, it's like 30,000, it's not the biggest utility in the world, but so we have two Minnesota related utilities that were among the recipients of the grants that the president announced earlier this week. And if I could make a plug for a smart grid workshop that we're having at the University of Minnesota on November 18th. Madam Chair, I recall that you attended our earlier one back in July. Well, we're having round two of that, trying to move the ball forward on smart grid in Minnesota. So we have another meeting we've scheduled. Again, it's going to be at the University's St. Paul campus, November 18th. It's a morning meeting. So if you have any interest in it, please see me for details. Thank you.
Can you, and we'll probably get an invitation via email, and we can forward that to committee members, will you already be sending that out to the...
Madam Chair, yes, we will send out to all the relevant committee members.
Thank you. That would be great. Yeah, and there's so much going on in this area. I think we really needed to get up to date on it. And I'm wondering, is that Sioux Valley Co-op in Senator, one of you three Southwestern Senator Vickerman? Your district is leading the way in Minnesota on the smart grid. Way to go. You're all smart. That's right. Where all the constituents are smarter and all the children are above average. Yeah. Thank you very much, Dr. Harp. There's no further questions. Oh, sorry. Hang on, please. I see a hand. Sorry, Representative Fox.
Thank you.
I have to ask if there are more questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Hart, just a question. You mentioned about transmission planning and some of the certificates or some of the processes going on. Could you explain that? What types of resources are being looked at? What the utilities are requesting? How does that line up with the policies that Minnesota has set forth to be on a track to renewable energy? And does that really coincide with some of our goals to have locally owned renewable? And I just bring it up because maybe, as you've heard, the recent FERC decision dealing with Community Wind North, which is a 20-megawatt locally owned project in my district, which they had been assessed, I believe it was $15 million in line upgrades, when a 115-megawatt utility project was assessed, basically no upgrade costs. And how does that come into play? And what can our state do to make sure that there's a level playing field between both utility-owned projects and non-utility-owned projects?
Madam Chair, Representative, there are a number of initiatives underway regionally in our with our neighboring states, across the Midwest ISO footprint, and even across the Eastern Interconnection, all dealing with transmission planning. I would say all of those, certainly the more local ones, are driven by the need to satisfy the renewable energy standard. Is how do we get the transmission infrastructure in place to allow the utilities and the states to accomplish those goals as we go forward? So they've really been prompted by the creation of those goals. And that's the focus. That's the focus of what's taking place. And there's the Upper Midwest Transmission Development Initiative that involves the five states, that's an initiative of the governors of all of those states. And our chairman, David Boyd, has been co-chairing that, and that's moving along very well. The Midwest ISO is a 14-state area, as you know. That has a transmission planning process. In fact, I was listening to it as I was sitting here earlier. They're meeting today to talk about cost allocation. That's moving forward. So all of this, and then, as I said, there's a much broader Eastern Interconnection, which is basically everything east of the Mississippi River, essentially, and thereabouts. So there's a lot of activity, and as I say, most of it, virtually all of it, is focused on accommodating and helping us all realize the goals that have been established, and also taking measures to enhance reliability going forward, in order to meet needs into the future.
Representative Falk, and this is a really, really important issue, but I'm not sure if it's something we can spend a lot of time on today. So, Representative Falk, just briefly.
Thank you. I'll be brief. I guess my question is really what's being done to hold some of these certificates accountable, because with the latest DG study that came out, I don't have it in front of me, but I believe the number was a request for additional 4,000 megawatts of base load for the supposed 10,000 megawatts of potential renewable energy. Is that accurate? I mean, so I think that there's definitely two sides here, and I want to make sure that the public interests are being put forward, and it's not just a one-sided utility. We're going to take what they're requesting without asking some tough questions.
Madam Chair, Representative, I want to. I should have mentioned this in my earlier comments that the processes that are underway right now, the planning processes, are stakeholder processes. Really, they are. There are representatives from all significant sectors that are participating in those efforts, and there's an understanding that there has to be agreement on how we resolve these, and that there are a number of policy objectives that have to be accommodated, and there's an effort being made to do that. So.
All right, thank you, Representative
Kalin. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just little bug in your ear on the planning side, to return to my notion of that I talked about earlier, the cost effectiveness. I was actually reading the September issue of Public Utilities fortnightly, and and understand that we're not alone, and all the grid operators. It is a little bit like Bubblegum Quarterly, for those of you who are wondering. But that I hope that as part of that planning process, that that you and the commissioners will be insisting that MISO look at the lowest cost-effective way to meet our planning resources, and that we use stimulus dollars and other long-term planning to do the lowest cost-effective way of doing so, not appeasing and meeting the profit motivation solely of the utilities, which have a strong profit motive. We're going to be having this conversation next session, I hope, on protecting ratepayers to going after the most cost-effective way and making rates work that way. But I hope that all of this is about ratepayer protection and protecting our ratepayers by actually meeting our needs through the public interest, not through the just through the profit motive, but aligning them better. Just a bug. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. All right. Thank you so much for being here. Let's take Kyle Macarius, please, from Carpenter Jim. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kyle Macarios. I am the political director of the North Central States Regional Council of Carpenters. I appreciate the opportunity to share some comments with you briefly this morning. My comments, I'd like to focus directly on the low-income weatherization program funded. Our union was very excited about the weatherization assistance program under the stimulus fund, and it's promised to be a win-win-win. I think we heard a lot in these rooms. A win for the environment by making homes more efficient, a win for communities by making sure low-income homeowners can afford their heating bills, and a win for workers by creating good-paying jobs. And we were particularly encouraged when the legislature included this language in the final conference report on Senate File 657. The language is, contracts funded in whole or in part under Articles 2 to 4 must, to the extent practicable, ensure that bidding contractors are qualified and participate in available apprentice and training programs for all work performed. This language, in addition to requiring that contractors can competently perform weatherization work, lays the groundwork to ensure that jobs created under this program can lead to long, productive careers in the construction industry, even after this one-time funding has gone away. We have, the Carpenters Union has engaged productively, in my opinion, with the Higher Minnesota Coalition that we're going to hear from soon, over our shared concerns with these funds, that contracting decisions are made with these funds are done thoughtfully and in a way that benefit all of our communities. But weatherization specifically lends itself to these goals very well because of the unique way that the work is performed. Many of you know this, but weatherization is performed on two-person crews, and one of the people on these crews needs to really know what they're doing. It's performed by a journey-level carpenter. But the other person on the crew, under a great model, can be an entry-level position, an apprentice. By following this model, we could manage the job of both putting skilled construction trades workers back to work and by offering new opportunities for people in our communities to come into the construction industry. And just as importantly, when the money dries up, this is one-time funding after all, when this money dries up, we will not have laid-off weatherization workers who have some very specific skill set experience. But these new entrants into the construction industry, while they perform weatherization work and get some construction experience under their belt, they will continue their schooling, they will learn the other aspects of the carpentry trade, so that when they're laid off, when the money dries up, they can then go to work framing houses or forming concrete or hanging ceilings, as it may be. They will learn the rest of the carpentry trade. We do have some concerns and questions about the number of contractors that are being hired with these funds who follow this model. Specifically, we're concerned that there's been little or no guidance given to local community action agencies by the state regarding this language, and that each community action agency is reacting to it differently. I do want to take this opportunity to publicly applaud Community Action of Ramsey and Washington Counties, who on every crew that they send out to weatherized homes, employ an apprentice. Their model is one which we wish was followed more widely and which has great promise. Our hope is that their model will be followed more widely to ensure that the promise of good jobs for our communities with these funds can be made a reality. That's all my comments, Madam Chair, unless there's any questions.
Thank you. thank you very much for bringing that point home. That's something, again, that's in our law, and we had a lot of discussion about, and I think the only thing you maybe didn't mention is that it also represents an opportunity to save a little money for the project, because the apprentice actually gets paid, you know, a little bit lower training wage, and it's still a good wage, and getting them into those long-term job opportunities. But it's just a kind of a win-win to be setting up our project that way, and we need it to happen around the state. So thank you for bringing that up. Other questions? All right. Thanks, Mr. McCarty. Appreciate it. All right. I want to ask, why doesn't the Higher Coalition come on up, the speakers? But I want to ask, I know there's a couple of folks who've come a long distance to be here today with CAP agencies from around the state, and I just want to make sure if there's anyone from out of the metropolitan area who has a time constraint and needs to leave soon, just let us know, and we can take you earlier in the agenda. But if nobody comes forward, you're okay? Good. Thank you. And we're on schedule. I think we'll be fine to be adjourned somewhere around 1 o'clock, I hope. Welcome to the committee, the joint committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and also Chair Hilty for another opportunity to talk to you. It's kind of nice to be here not at 11 o'clock at night, so we're enjoying that as well. We are the Higher Coalition. I'm Jeff Bauer. I'm the Director of Public Policy for Family and Children's Service, which is actually the oldest nonprofit in the state of Minnesota. I have with me Lewis King, who most of you know. He's the President and CEO of Summit Academy OIC. A lot of their great students are sitting in the back here, and they're able to be with us today again, and we're glad for that. And Karen Monahan, who is the environmental justice organizer for EJAM, and they'll be talking to you in a little bit. So just to reintroduce HIGHER very briefly, we're a coalition of over 70 community organizations, and we have a particular interest in making sure that public investments are made equitably in Minnesota. And for us, that means making sure low-income communities and communities of color have equitable representation in these investments. And so last session, we spent a lot of time on this bill, Senate File 657, when we had three main points that we were working on: training dollars and training opportunities for low-income folks, outreach into these communities, and also transparency and reporting requirements. We've talked a lot about that today, so we won't belabor that point too much here. And because of the leadership of a lot of the people around this room and a lot of people around the table right there, that bill was passed and signed into law with all of those provisions included in it. And Senator Anderson knows, and certainly Representative Kalin from his work on the national level, that bill really has become a national model of how to draft inclusive, equitable legislation. And so we're really proud to have been a part of that. Over the summer, also Senator Anderson alluded to, the first RFP came out in the metro area to start actually hiring contractors to do this weatherization work. We saw that RFP, and at the time we're pretty alarmed that it didn't seem to include any of the provisions that we've discussed in Senate File 657. One of the main concerns we shared, obviously, with Mr. Makarios and some other organized labor groups was that the apprenticeship and training requirements didn't appear in that original RFP. And so we got in touch with several of the community action programs who are here today and really want to applaud them for being extremely willing to sit down and work through these hard issues and have many, many meetings with us. I think we came a long way. And so Kyle also referred to the Ramsey Community Partnership, where we really found a great way to combine community interests, apprenticing and labor, and the Community Action Program's interests, and we'd like to hold that up as a model as well. And so while we're here, I'd like to thank Mr. Gray is in the back, Mr. Davis from Minneapolis Community Action, certainly Mr. Hightower and Mr. Anderson, and also Mr. Makarios for really taking the equity language seriously and working with us throughout the summer on that. And certainly Senator Anderson for bringing us all together and making us play nice all summer. Thank you for that. So I'm going to turn it over to Mr. King. He's going to just bring up a couple very specific points about training, and then turn it over to Ms. Monahan, if that's okay.
Thanks very much, Mr. Bauer. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you, Madam.
And thank you all so much for your work during this session to put together such a great piece of legislation.
Thank you, Madam.
So it's our job to make sure that it all comes true. Mr. King, you were next.
Madam Chair.
Welcome.
Melissa King, President and CEO of Summit Academy OIC, and also co-founder of Higher Minnesota. I'm proud to be flanked by these two young people, whom all of you know work very diligently, to represent the interests of communities who are not often heard in the policy debate. And my background, I was a soldier for 10 years and led troops in many places, and also a school board member. So God bless you as elected officials. Mm-hmm. We thank you for your service. What I learned, though, in both of those pursuits, is that training is everything. The presence of democracy and freedom is really based on how well our soldiers are trained. This is no different than teaching in classrooms. And as Kyle alluded to earlier, we need to have adequately trained people from all of our communities if we're to implement this program well. We are happy that the weatherization RFP for training is now on the streets, and we'll push resources forward so that we can get players into the game, not just for the short term, but as Kyle noted, we train our people in a very robust manner so that they can be workers in other industries that support weatherization in the future as our current workforce shrinks. We also understand that there will be 1 million in training for the residential and commercial energy efficiency and renewable energy training available sometime early in 2010, and we will be ready to respond to that as well. There are two final pieces I wish to touch on. The first is thank you for your leadership. It was roughly 12 months ago that you brought the Green Job Task Force to the Urban League in North Minneapolis. As a result of that, the people that you see in this room got involved in the process. A lot of the talk here today has been about rules and regulations and jargon. And it forgot three very important words. We, the people. And the people that you see in this room, especially these students are here and have been in the policy debate. They will take place and utilize the training dollars, and then they will actually get jobs doing weatherization. So because of your leadership, you are allowing people to participate in the full spectrum of this operation, and we really want to thank you for that, because if not, the emphasis oftentimes is on projects and rules, and we forget the people. And we really do want to impress upon you, we view this as a partnership, and we're working very diligently. I really want to thank Kyle and the Carpenters, because of his work, we put memorandums of understandings in place between labor and Higher Minnesota that can be used as models across the board to strengthen our workforce. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you very much, Mr. King. And I have to say, whenever I hear you speak, I'm always educated and inspired. So thank you. And can I just ask how many of these students, how many people in the room, this is your first time at the Capitol? Anybody? All right. Some of you have already been lobbying here before. Anyway, I want to welcome you and just say again that having you here makes a difference, and being a voice for your community and for your aspirations to have a green job and be part of the solution for our planet and our community is really fantastic. And so we just want to welcome you here. Ms. Monahan.
Madam Chair, I want to thank you for your leadership. I also would like to thank OES for getting the RFP out on the street. Higher has forwarded the RFP to many groups with deep connections in targeted communities, and we look forward to seeing some of them receive funding for this work. We have a particular interest in ensuring that communities with barriers to accessing energy efficiency information, for example, language barriers, are made a priority in the reviews. Once again, I would like to thank you. I would like to thank OES for getting the RFP on the street, and I'm going to now turn it over to Jeff Power.
If only we could all be so succinct in our testimony. So I just have two more very quick points. I know we have more people to get up here, the community action programs and others. The final piece, of course, that we were interested in was the public reporting and accountability. There's been a lot said about that today. On the sheet that you have in front of you, the Article 5, Subsection 2 We worked very hard to make sure that this language was included, and the language was that weatherization providers and contractors would need to provide the number of people employed for low-income, people of color, rural communities, all kinds of things, so that we can actually see where this money is getting and take corrective action if it's not getting there. And, you know, by corrective action, that may mean saying, look, Ramsey County has a great model of how to work with these programs to diversify your workforce. But we believe very strongly that that language must be included in what's being requested of the providers and the contractors, and we look forward to seeing that information as soon as it's available. And just a final point again about the apprenticeship and training programs that's near and dear to our hearts. Mm-hmm. We would also like to see that be an aspect that must be reported on by the providers and the contractors, which of those programs they're participating in, which are available in their areas, and how that information is going. So thank you again for this opportunity to testify before you today. We really appreciate it, and we'd be glad to answer any questions that the committee has.
All right, thank you so much. Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Senator Anderson, and thank you folks for your work and partnership over the last year. I think that the bill in both concept and language was stronger because of your engagement. We need to make sure that the reality reflects the aspiration. And so appreciate you guys continually being involved. No surprise whatsoever that you are. You know, Representative Clark, Chair Clark, I and some of you wrote that language from the very beginning. It was the first hearing, and we fought hard to keep that language on the targeted communities, but including any community that has disproportionately high rates of unemployment. And so I look forward to the January report when we have more data to really drill down and see, and I know that we're all going to hold them accountable. As you know, my concern on the training dollars was that we want to make sure that we're not creating a pipeline of workers and then not having the projects to put them to work. And so I'm wondering if you could just maybe share what you're seeing out there for now and hope that we'll at every single one of the four hearings so we can revisit this issue, because I want to make sure that we are putting people to work as well as building skill sets for the long haul.
Madam Chair. Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Kalin, we'd like to acknowledge many of the complexities and barriers that you've heard in earlier testimony as impeding the process of $5 million of $132 million, or a very large number. So we accept the fact that we're early in the process. However, at the same time, the groups that were mentioned by Mr. Bauer, the CAPS, Labor, and HIRE, have worked very diligent with our contractors to employ people. So we've actually gotten some people out the door and on jobs. So there is a drip occurring. We expect that as the barriers and complexities are resolved and the system kicks in, we will see more, because in spite of the lack of guidance, the people on the ground have figured out how to work together, and the contractors have been made aware that their feet will be held to the fire by the people in charge. And I want to thank the CAPS for their leadership. In addition to that structural group working together to make this possible, though, we've identified other markets where these people can go. The public housing authorities have their initiatives. Both cities have their retrofits that are going to occur. We anxiously await the NSP work. We anxiously await the word on the government building retrofits as well. And then finally, we are in conversations with Sheldon Strom and his operation as well. So we're not simply focusing on the work of the CAPS, but we're also looking at other markets and other ways to get the folks out there so they can utilize these skills while that pipeline begins to fully develop.
And just a quick follow-up. I think that's exactly the kind of leveraging not because of our committee structure we tend to live within boxes, and I think that we need to look at every opportunity. I hope that you guys will be engaged with OES on the retrofit ramp-up and the $75 million potential application for the EECBG competitive piece, because I know that the Department of Labor is looking for not only the skilled trades and the training programs that exist that are privately funded, to leverage those, but also to make sure that, that access and pathways out of poverty and are key components in those grants from DOL, and I hope that Department of Labor, excuse me, sorry about acronyms, and I know the Department of Energy is also going to be, I think it's going to be a stronger application so that we can be cost-effective by moving people to self-sufficiency and stop reliance on needing more support, but replace that with paychecks. So really appreciate your work. Thanks.
All right. Any other questions? If not, thank you so much for being here, and thank you for your ongoing presence in this important work. All right. Let's bring Project Re-Energize. First, we have the Sarah Joynton. If you wouldn't mind, well, I guess you're not a group, so we'll start with, and then we'll have the Builders Association. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. All right. Mr. Brewington?
Yeah. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Jared Brewington with the Metropolitan Contracting Group. I'm the general manager and senior partner. We're a construction firm, and we have a newer focus on renewable energy and integration for residential consumers. We're also a consumer and market partner resource in those endeavors. And by resource, what we do is we're helping provide a total solution to homeowners other than providing just service delivery, education, and referral network with our affiliates. For our market partners, we provide industry updates, program rollouts, and incentives, as well as selling tools as our market perceives it. Those partners include market leaders such as Coldwell Banker Burnett, who we provide with program and market news by way of regular staff meetings with their management. These partnerships allow all the elements of our industry to be connected for a seamless and caring solution for homeowners. Just want to state that it's wonderful to see Mr. King and his supporters from Summit Academy OIC. It's a strong testament to the reach we can have with continued national and state support for our communities and its immediate impact on the workforce and consumers. And then consumers will receive quality service delivery. So it's good to see that representation today. My stance as a builder and consumer resource leads me to be involved in programs such as Project Re-Energize, the anticipation of the Energy Saver rebates through the Fix-Up Fund, and the Minnesota Solar Rebate Program. I just want to share a couple brief examples of the involvement of Project Re-Energize with the actual consumer. One of my clients, Sarah Burwald, is a single woman living in St. Paul who had planned to get some Energy Star rated windows in her home because she was having cost difficulties with her energy. It was a little out of her league as far as financing went. Once Project Re-Energize was rolled out on October 1st, she was able to make that project happen. So that was a direct benefit and an immediate benefit for her. And that, coupled with the 30% or $1,500 federal tax incentive, the timeliness of this project was well planned out, because she's going to see a front-end and back-end benefit to that very soon. So it truly is a good service. Another client, which was one of the other driving points for Project Re-Energize, to help homeowners, to incite homeowners to continue on with that project that they had in mind but couldn't afford, Renee Pillsbury of Delano, Minnesota, single mother going through a divorce, was planning on renovating her home for some long-term equity gain, and also commit some energy-efficient upgrades to her home for some short-term cost savings. This project helped push Project Re-Energize helped push that project over the hump for her, so she was able to continue on with it. So the impact is direct. These programs definitely did help push those projects, and in regards to the Energy Saver rebate through the Fix-Up Fund through the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, this is going to help create jobs for laborers and professionals in real estate and a better equity position than new buyers that are already buying at below market value. You know, with fixed rate mortgages being the standard now, we're away from a lot of the things that got us into a tough pickle in the housing market right now, and this will assist in the loan to value being more livable in the foreseeable future. Actually, 53 to around 57% of all remodels and renovations are new buyers, and when they're getting in homes at a decent premium, and there's programs like this to help them update their homes for an immediate cost savings and help stabilize the market. I hope our input's welcome on the dispersion of those rebates as the anticipated program is rolled out. There are some things that we believe in, some of the affiliations we have, compiled thoughts that could definitely help this program by way of how those rebates are dispersed. And our involvement with the Minnesota solar rebate program, and it coupled with the federal tax incentives up to 30% of the cost without a cost maximum, are good examples of how consumers can enter a new energy, new realm of energy efficiency and independence for a premium that's never been seen before. Those components coupled together will have homeowners doing an renewable energy integration in almost 50% below the actual retail cost of it. I know the funds aren't endless. However, it's well worth stating that the impact and results are immediate and documented, and it does affect consumers and businesses and creating work and activity. So I thank you on behalf of my firm for your time and your considerations, Madam Chair.
Great. Thank you very much for your testimony. Ms. Weaver?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pam Perry Weaver. I'm the Executive Vice President of the Builders Association of Minnesota. We were provided a grant from the Department of Commerce and OES to put together Project Reenergize, and I wanted to give you a brief overview of what it is. Rather than going from an agency to a directly to the contractor, this program goes from the consumer to the contractor. No one can sell energy efficiency better than a small business person and a contractor. Jared just gave you an overview of the clients that he's working with. I brought two other companies with me who I've also benefited from Project Reenergize. So I want to thank OES for kind of thinking outside of the box and going directly to small business and asking our opinion on how to incentivize consumers in this very difficult economy to spend money on their houses for energy efficiency. So I want to ask Bob and Gary to come up and tell you a little bit from the business perspective.
And Mr. Brewington, don't go far. There may be questions for you. All right, welcome.
Hi. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Joan Olson. My husband and I own Gary D. Olson Company in Crystal. We're a small building contractor who specialize in the exterior of the house, siding and roofing and windows and doors and items like that. When we were notified from the Builders Association of Minnesota to participate in this program, an email went out, I believe an invitation went out to all the licensed contractors in the state for the training. We took the training. During the training seminar, the contractors were told to spread the word. And it was exciting. On October 1st, as soon as this program rolled out, the phone started to ring, and that's something we had not had happen the whole entire season. I mean, we were in the process of laying off our employees, and now we said, well, wait a minute, maybe we can hire some more people. People are really excited. People are really interested. We signed up our first two homeowners right away. This was homeowner-based. They went on the list. They found the qualified contractors, and they called us. We went out, and we bid the jobs. They were excited. We filled out the forms. We sent them in, and then we waited for more forms to come back in so that we could get other consumers, other homeowners that were interested, we could get them to fix up their house. And then we were told that there was no more funding, that they were out of money. So now we ended up having to lay off our employees. Okay, this Project Reenergize is a win-win situation. It was good for the small business owner, the contractor. It's good for the homeowner. They could do work around their house. It wasn't income-based. It wasn't, you know, they didn't... All they had to do was the need had to be there, and they were getting a rebate. It wasn't, you know, there were no other qualifications except that they had to go ahead with the job. I have dozens of customers waiting who are calling me and saying, if you get more money, call us. We'll be there in 15 minutes with a check to sign a contract. So this was good for the business, good for the homeowner, and great for the environment because
our first homeowner that signed up, that they were so excited because right now, when they go to bed, they can feel the wind coming in through their windows, and they're so excited not to have that happen this winter. Because now our first group of windows are in, and we're installing them next week, or if the rain ever stops. So I'm not sure. But all I'm asking and all we'd like to do, this is a good program. This was a very good thing for everybody. And we would like to see more money allocated to this program. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for hearing us today. My name is Bob Buck. I own Buck Brothers Construction Company. We are an urban core remodeler in the Twin Cities. Now, we do more general remodeling, but the landscape's changed for us in the last 2 years. Part of this is exactly what Terry's been talking about. I've laid off about half of our staff this year. We're looking at probably 50% of the revenues as we're accustomed to. We're changing by understanding that we can't do the jobs that we used to do, which were larger jobs. And we understand that consumers are looking for smaller ways to work on their homes. This whole program fits that very well. We've had the same experience of when we got the training for this. When it went online on October 1st, we started getting phone calls. We have a website. I monitor that. The hits on the website went up immediately. I've talked to a number of homeowners. Again, right away, we sold the two applications that was available to all contractors. So no contractor could actually corner the market on this. All of us shared in the rewards from this program. We sold those right away. We're still talking to people, and it generates more work from the people that we've been able to sign on beyond the scope of the program. It's also generating interest in homeowners in trying to do something with their homes. We've got a couple of contractors ready to sign with people who were originally interested in signing on with the project Reenergize. They know it's not available. There are other federal monies available, so they still want to do something. So the other part of what this program is doing is not just creating, opportunities from the monies that are available through the government, but also homeowners are pitching in on this. This is probably the first thing they've seen come along that gives them hope that there's some reason to invest in their homes, and I'm sure you're all aware that that's not something that people have been thinking of in the last couple, 3 years. So, again, I want to reiterate how successful this has been, how we really appreciate the work that the BAM has done to help create this and the work that you've done to get this money to us quickly and to make it available to people in a very simple manner. Thank you for hearing me.
Thank you very much, Mr. Buck. Appreciate your testimony. Representative Kalin. Representative Wealthy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifiers or someone else from BAM that can answer the question, I've had residents in my area contact me because they had applied or they'd contacted a contractor and then found out that the contractor didn't have any more applications left or packets left. And so I'm trying to figure out how this program was rolled out. Was it that each contractor throughout the state received two packets? And if that's the case, then I just want to know, was it population-based? Was it just whoever was a contractor got the two packets? I just want to know how this was administered throughout the state, and were there any contractors that got more than two packets?
Madam Chair, Representative Wealthy, it's a great question, and we've answered that a lot. There are 13,000 licensed contractors in the state of Minnesota who were invited to participate. We received funding to train 900. So we were limited right off the bat there. We made sure that the contractors that we trained were geographically distributed throughout the state. We did 13 trainings throughout the state. We did that the last 2 weeks of September. But it was surely a first-come, first-serve program whereby all 13,000 licensed contractors received a letter from the Builders Association with some pretty plain language about what we were doing. Basically, it said free money for your consumers. So if you don't respond to that, I'm not sure what you'd respond to. So that's how we contacted all contractors. Then based on the money that we received, we initially gave each trained contractor two packets. because, you know, the mass, just if we gave them more than that, there wouldn't be money, and we didn't want to recreate a cash for clunkers situation.
Representative Welty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then just one follow-up. Okay, so you said that they're geographically distributed, but are they geographically distributed based upon population, or is it just that we have a few contractors in northern Minnesota that got it, a few contractors in southern Minnesota, and then you had some in the metro? So was that taken into account, the population densities and the state?
Madam Chair, Representative Welty, not to that specific degree. It was metro and the rest of the state. But we did do the trainings like I said, 12 different locations throughout the state.
Representative
Kalin. Thank you, Madam Chair. As I think you might recall, Madam Chair, and Chair Hilty and I, as we discussed the stimulus bill early on and really wanting to maximize the stimulus, our priority was to make programs work so that we could get the dollars in the hands of people who could spend them and create jobs and save energy. And I think this is a great example, your testimony today, great example of a successful program where the frustrations are frustrations because it's working. And they're the kind of frustrations that we need to have more of. So I think that we need to look at how we can go to the next step and keep the program working so it's not just extending but actually leveraging. And I'm going to just walk over after this to make sure that you guys, that the contractors that you have, the recovery through retrofit announcement from the White House looking at exactly this piece, the potential to cut home energy bills by $21 billion annually around the country, and to address those barriers of lack of access to information, financing, and skilled workers. Well, information and skilled workers are not our barrier in Minnesota, thanks to BAM, contractors, to our labor friends who are in the room, and the work that this legislature has done for decades. So it's the financing. So let's keep talking, and as we look to the next session and the job task force in the House looks at how we can keep good things going and grow them, let's talk about how we can make that happen.
Ms. Weaver.
Madam Chair, Representative Galen, absolutely. And I can tell you the department is being very, very diligent about data collection. So we are collecting what they need to answer the questions that you've been asking today. So,
well, that's great. That was going to be my
They're
question.
On top of us big time. They're on top of us, so thanks.
That's great. I wanted to check with your contractors, so thank you for bringing that up. So you know that you're collecting information about jobs, hours created, and personnel, as well as, are you able to focus on energy savings as well?
Madam Chair, yes. I mean, we will be on those projects that there have been air sealing. Mm-hmm. We are doing the blower door tests and that type of thing. So, and we are doing some calculations on the new window installations as well. So.
Okay. And Representative Kalin is suggesting there may be more money available. So it's a great opportunity to partner with the department on, presumably, or I'm not sure who would make the application.
And
Representative Kalin?
Madam Chair, I don't know that I actually just sent an email. I just heard back from our contact, DOE contact in the White House about kind of what this next phase will be on the recovery through retrofit. I think we have actually an opportunity to help shape how that might look. And so I think we'll talk some more about getting that information. I know the White House and others are looking at some on-the-ground successes, not just to tell the story, but actually to say this is maybe where we could help craft the next phase, and I know that's why Minnesotans have been asked to participate in that conversation. So I'll make sure that Ms. Smith has the recovery through retrofit report. I'm going to just give this to you as well, the one I just printed, but I think it's a helpful blueprint for where we could go.
Thank you. Ms. Weaver?
Madam Chair, Representative, we went through $2.5 million in 3 weeks. So the contractors did a great job.
So, Ms. Weaver, just a couple of questions on that. So, were some of these jobs that were already lined up, and then they had an opportunity to sort of make them even more cost-effective. Is that possible?
Madam Chair, the answer is that the contract between the contractor and the homeowner could not be signed prior to October 1st. So, but there were, all the contractors were trained those last 2 weeks of September. So once they were trained, the intention was for them, if they were working with consumers who were considering remodeling their home, this would tip them over. I mean, I think the contractors would tell you that they have been working, consumers have been calling, but just waiting to spend money. Everyone is uncomfortable spending money in this economy. So this was the pushover.
Oh, and I, you know, as a homeowner with one of those old non-historic leaky houses, you know, I've gotten some bids on things that I'm waiting until my ship comes in, you know, and this was the ship that came in for some folks, and I've, you know, a lot of us want to do the work and just can't afford it, and so I think that's why we're hearing, a lot of folks are hearing in their district from people who want to take advantage of this, and the money went so quickly. Representative Westrum.
Madam Chair, a couple questions. First of all, maybe to Representative Kalin, if I heard you right, are you giving us the inclination that there's a phase two, a round two of the stimulus bill coming from Washington? I've been hearing speculative news reports, but do you have any insight on that?
Madam Chair, Representative Westrum.
Representative Kalin.
I think that I'm going to make sure that, in addition to getting it to Ms. Smith, I'll email you directly the link from the Recovery Through Retrofit report. And it's a PDF. I think it should work for you. That I think there's a desire to leverage the funds that still have to be sent to the states or still being spent and from the existing stimulus. And the focus on the Recovery Through Retrofit is actually on leveraging, working with private markets and private financiers. For instance, we can talk some more about this, but Citigroup has been working on Department of Energy and Clean Economy Network, a national association of clean economy, clean energy folks, on the Retrofit Roadshow, they're calling it, that where Citigroup is saying we have a financing mechanism that's the private sector financing that can leverage hundreds of millions or billions of dollars of investments in private finance, retrofitting by connecting contractors who are ready to do the work. I think it's that kind of win-win public-private partnership that gets bipartisan support around here and from a lot of us. So I haven't heard real strong support for a second stimulus like next week, but I think it's how do we free up the private capital that needs to happen to get us to a full, robust economy again.
Okay. Madam Chair, I didn't ask it to be a joke. I know he's sitting right next to me, but I thought others might want to hear the response, and so that's why I didn't just lean over and ask him the question. To the witness, is there, and this might be from Commerce, and we might have to have them come up and answer this question, or Madam Chair, maybe you know, what I've heard is your money went out the door fast. There's other dollars through the stimulus package we passed through the legislature that haven't moved as fast. Are we in jeopardy of not getting some of those dollars spent before they're gone, and or is there a way to shift some around to add to your program? And I had contractors calling me that didn't get in on the 900 training sessions, and are they going to just be out in the cold, or how would you structure or frame a future allocation of money to your organization? And is there a reason we don't maybe shift more money, or the department doesn't shift more money your direction to make this happen? And last question, part of this, I'll just lump it all in here. I don't recall, on your program, was there income guidelines, or what was the means testing? And because I believe the CAP agencies are all means tested. Is that the same with yours?
You're right about that. So these were not means tested. These were open, based, not based on income. No requirements for income. Let me just let the department answer your questions, please. Who wants to address that? Mr. DeBibri.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Westrom, I'll try and get as many of the points that I can remember from your question. Are we in danger of somehow jeopardizing the federal funds? That I would say that peril still exists as far as federal capacity to move funds if we don't perform. I don't think that we are in a position that is endangering that possibility within the time frame that they're talking about. I think we're going to meet their performance guidelines, their timelines for spending, and the return on the investment as far as energy and jobs is concerned. I'm confident.
Do you want to talk about the overall homeowner appropriation, Mr. or Director Glahn? I mean, we put more money into homeowner efficiency programs, Representative Westrom, and so maybe you could just comment on where the rest of the money, I assume it's the MHFA program that's headed for?
Madam Chair, Representative Westrom, that's correct. The remainder of the funding, the $7.65 million that was appropriated for the residential energy efficiency programs, is going to be devoted to rebates that will be available to fix up fund borrowers, which is the MHFA loan program, that install Energy Star improvements such as high efficiency furnaces, windows, and insulation air sealing. The question of reallocation of funds to this successful purpose is one that was certainly considered and a mechanism put into place in Chapter 138. It does require a finding on our part that funds as appropriated are not going to achieve the purpose that they were intended for or within the timeline. The NEPA issues that we're having with some things may lead us to that conclusion on some things, but I think we need to resolve those issues before we can make a defensible claim that those things aren't going to happen.
So, Madam Chair, Mr. DeFever, so if I'm understanding right, we've got at least the three pots, the $2.5 million that went out in 3 weeks. Projects are done or soon done. We've got the MHFA housing finance, $7.6 million. That's not out, but in the process of persons that apply for fix-up funds, that will get them soon or shortly, and then there's much larger amount that's going out through the CAP agencies, the weatherization, which would be means tested. If some of those funds can't get allocated, you've got the authority or ability to shift them to other venues or back to a program that we've now seen a model that worked fast. Am I recapping this correctly? In the MHFA, is that means tested as well, or is that, what's the status of that?
And just briefly, Representative Westrom, about $130 million went to the weatherization program, which is constrained by federal law, and goes up to those up to 200% of poverty level. And so this was part of the state energy program. We had about, 60-some million to appropriate there, and we had to choose among a lot of really valuable approaches for saving energy, including public buildings, commercial industrial buildings, et cetera. And so we divided the pie up in a way that seemed fair and also a way designed to best meet the goals of saving energy and putting people to work. And yes, this is incredibly popular. And we did, in our bill, we were very adamant that homeowners need grant rebates and that loans in today's market and today's economy are just not going to help a lot of people because they don't want to take on more debt and aren't able to oftentimes. And this, I think this shows that we were right, but you know, obviously the demand, we could probably give out $100 million to do this across the state and replace all those windows in all those old non-historic homes. But I'm not sure if we're going to get there, but I hope we can find a way to get more of that done, because it's obviously there's a huge demand. Mr. DeFebri or Mr. Glahn, do you want to say something?
Madam Chair, Bill Glahn, Representative Westrom. Thank you for providing the bulk of the answer I was going to provide, so I appreciate your assistance in that. To specifically answer your question about the MHFA program, there is an income guideline, and my understanding, the household income guideline for that is $96,500, which is considerably higher than the weatherization. I know, Senator Anderson, you included this in your response, but I did want to just to reiterate that we have the low-income weatherization, which is means-tested, and we do not have any flexibility to move money out of that and into some other program, regardless of the success or relative success of another program. But within the state energy office funds, we do have, through the state statute, an ability to, with notice and with the finding that Mr. DeFebri described, move money amongst programs there. And so I can't provide any assurance or any guarantees of what will happen going forward, but this is exactly the situation we anticipated in writing in that flexibility, that we would have efforts that were met with spectacular success and perhaps other efforts that would encounter barriers that would jeopardize our getting funds out by the deadline that was set for us, which is September 30th, 2010. So we may, as we go forward, come back to you with suggestions about moving funds around to take advantage of proven successes like the BAM program and where we've hit walls to shift funds away. But I did want to mention, as we appreciate the contractors and BAM coming and sharing their success story with me, but I think you alluded to this, Madam Chair, in your response a moment ago, that every program has a constituency and their own champions. And I had somebody come up to me in the tunnel on the way to this hearing saying, can we shift more funds to commercial industrial? So everybody has their own interest, and what we will do, Representative Wester, we will in the interim here look at where are we having success, where are we hitting barriers, and may come back to you and your fellow legislators with suggestions for shifting funds.
And Director Glahn, the only thing I would add to that excellent explanation is that, as you said, some of the programs haven't opened, the funding hasn't gone out the door yet. The commercial industrial, for example, because you're just getting the RFP out. And so they may meet with, as you said, and this is what you were alluding to, they may meet with the same level of excitement and spectacular success and demand as this program. And I think if that is the case, we'll find that it's not just a matter of shifting money. It's that we could spend a heck of a lot more money to this end. And I think the public wants it, and the industries that hire the people that do this kind of work need it. The construction industry, the building industry, the energy retrofit industry, they all need, there's a great need for more jobs. And so we have the jobs, we have the demand, we just don't have the money. So that's always a slight barrier.
Madam Chair.
Representative Weston.
Just one last follow-up. I guess, first of all, I'll just take a little exception to what you say, that the public wants it. The public that's paying the bill or will have to pay the bill in the future may not be as giddy about it as we sometimes think. I agree with you. The jobs are needed, et cetera, but anytime you hand out free money, people will probably be there to take it, just like manna from heaven, but unfortunately we can't create manna from heaven. So I just think we need to keep that in perspective, that this, anytime you hand out free money, of course people are going to be wildly excited to come and grab it, because it's like a gold rush. But the day of reckoning probably is still coming, and we all, I think, have that concern in the back of our mind, and what is going to happen as we just keep cranking up the printing presses is still a great concern. But Ms. Weaver, just your program, if you could just explain, how did everybody got notice, as you said, the 13,000 licensed contractors,
was it just first come, first serve, and those that didn't get in just because they were a half hour too late to call back and reserve a spot? Or, and I particularly had at least one contractor call me right away and said, what's going on here? I did everything. I was gotten a notice, and I now can't even get into a class. How do you pick those? Is it cherry picking, or how's the notice gone out, and how do people have to respond? And if another program was to come through, how would you do that? Would it be the same 900 people that just get it, and the other 12,000 some people are not going to be able to gain work this way, or what would that look like?
Madam Chair, Representative Westrom, we sent out a letter to the licensed contractors on September 4th, all 13,000, and the classes were online. So when you registered for the classes, you had to do it online. So there was no really cherry picking of who gets in and who doesn't.
Okay.
So it was random from that perspective. And
based on who signed up first?
Yeah, based on who got on the computer and signed up first.
Okay.
And we filled up the classes after the notices landed all, I think, on September 12th, because we followed up with the mailhouse. And the classes were all closed by September 25th. So there was about... They didn't close up the same day that we opened them. It was about a 12 or 13 day period until all the classes were filled. So there was a little bit of time there that someone could have signed up. To your second question, if we were to do this again, I think it would really be up to the department of what they would like us to do. I would make a recommendation that we invite additional contractors to participate. That would be my recommendation, but I haven't given it much thought other than that.
All right. Thanks.
Ms. Weaver, what was the extent of the training? How long did the training take?
Madam Chair, we did two sets of trainings. We did a two-hour training for general contractors, really on the paperwork, on how to fill out the paperwork for the rebates, and also the ramifications of air sealing in older homes. You know that when you change out your windows and you fill the holes, you change the performance of your home. So we wanted to make sure that there were there was training on that. The second set of training we did was particularly with the individuals in the state who do the air sealing work. That was an eight-hour training was also around the state, a hands-on training, and we trained about 250 air sealers throughout the state. And that was, an eight-hour training.
So, okay. Well, it is important to think about if there is more money ever allocated to this program. We have an investment in those who have been trained, but I also understand that there's a lot of folks who didn't get to participate. So, yeah, again, more demand than funds.
Well, Madam Chair, we're highly motivated to get our people back to work. So I think that's probably what contributed to our quick response from the department and the grant.
Ms. Weaver, is it ABC? I'm not sure which group that is. Is that part of your organization?
Madam Chair, no. Associated Builders and Contractors is commercial construction. The Builders Association of Minnesota is primarily residential construction. 95% of our contractors are small businesses in the state of Minnesota.
Well, I'm going to get in a huge amount of trouble, but I have to just make one quick editorial comment. And I apologize, because I know we're running out of time. But I would say that, you know, we spent a lot of time, Representative Kalin's been talking about our meetings with the White House, and we spent a lot of time in Washington the last couple of days talking about the benefits that would come from passing the climate and jobs bill. I would suspect that what that would do would be to drive that investment that you were talking about, Representative Kalin. That would change the economics of energy efficiency such that it would become an incredibly profitable enterprise, more than it is now, and would drive this type of
work across the country and the state. So I would hope that it would help. It would help the employment situation for some of these contractors that we're talking about to put a premium on saving energy. So I would really like to see that happen, and I hope that ABC is listening, as they don't seem to think it would be in their interest. End of editorial comment. Sorry. Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Weaver, I just going back to the issue of how contractors were notified of this. I would like to see if you could make that list available of the 900 to this committee. That would be very interesting to see who was on that. I think I'm not the only one that has that interest. And then there was one comment you made that made me just kind of wonder. When you talked about you mailed out the notifications, right, and then people responded online. What provisions did you make for contractors in areas that actually only have dial-up and have problems with responding to some of those things? And really, I actually have contractors in my area that have had discussions with me about problems where they have to respond online and they actually can't, which puts those folks at a disadvantage. What provisions did you make to accommodate their needs?
Madam Chair, Representative Taylor, if they couldn't get on online or they didn't have a computer, we encouraged phone calls. Our phone number was on there, and we would take their registration over the phone, but it did not happen very often. And also the classes were open. It was open for about 12 or 13 days, so there was time in there for folks to participate if they wanted. I'm sorry, your first question was... Did I answer your first question? Oh, the list.
Right.
I'm sorry. The list is available online. There's a website called projectreenergize.org. All 900 contractors are listed by county on that website, and I would really encourage you to go. Also, all the air sealers who've been trained are also on that website as well.
Very good. Thank you very much for the report. We really appreciate it. It's great to see how enthusiastically this is being received around this. Appreciate that very much. The CAP agencies are next, and I want members, please stay. This is about one of the most important parts of this hearing, but I also have to recognize that the Office of Energy Security indicated they had a conference call with the Department of Energy, so I think they'll have to leave, and we understand that. Thank you. But ask members, please stay and give your full attention to the CAP programs that are here, and a couple of them have come along distance to talk to us today.
Huh?
And that will be the conclusion of the hearing, I believe. I apologize, we're going to run just a few minutes over. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Chair Hilty. Thank you very much for this opportunity to present. We appreciate your continued interest in what's already been a very long day. My name is Arnie Anderson. I'm the director of the statewide Minnesota Community Action Partnership. Today we have four directors from local community action agencies. As you know, the Department of Energy Weatherization Program is both an exceptionally complex program technically, as well as being quite complicated, small p, politically. So the people who are implementing it on the front lines are here today. Clarence Hightower from the Community Action Partnership of Ramsey, Washington. Bill Davis from Community Action, Minneapolis. Bob Bennis from Lakes and Pines Community Action in Mora. And Harlan Tardy from AEOA in Virginia, Minnesota. I have two very brief comments before we go to the presenters. I have four press packets of articles on weatherization from the past month, and because I didn't think this would become a collector's item, I did not make copies for everyone, but I thought maybe you could pass them around, and I have provided copies to the committee administrators for others who are interested. It includes a listing of all the articles that have been published in since July. The second thing that I would say is in response to the question of where Minnesota stacks up nationally. Approximately a month ago, there was a national conference of state weatherization offices. And I think by acclamation among the peers of the state offices who are trying to administer this program, Minnesota was certainly one of the leaders, if not the leader. And I think all of us involved can be very proud of Minnesota's leadership in that regard. And so with that, I would like to introduce Clarence Hightower from Community Action Partnership for Ramsey, Washington.
Thank you very much, Mr. Anderson.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, my name is Clarence Hightower, and I am with the CAP agency that serves Ramsey County and Washington County, which also includes St. Paul, Minnesota. Our goal in those two counties is to weatherize 1,726 homes, and I'm here today to explain to you that we are well on the way toward that. Currently, we have weatherized 152 homes and have another 471 homes in the pipeline, meaning that they have gone through audits and are at some point close to completion, which gives us 623 homes, or 36% of our total homes, either completed or at some phase of completion relative to this work. In Ramsey, Washington County, we use what we call an in-house crew model. You have heard both Hired Minnesota and the unions talk about how effective this crew model is. We have on our crews a two-person crew, a journeyman carpenter, and an apprentice. So each of our crews have with it an apprentice person, which gives us the ability to get new folks into this kind of work, which we are excited about. As a matter of fact, currently we have about 27% of those that are doing this work in our crews are people of color, so that we feel tremendously good about. We also feel very good about our relationship with our union, Kyle Macario, so you heard from him earlier, and our agency and other agencies, as a matter of fact, have had just a wonderful working relationship, and we agree wholeheartedly that it is a win-win-win opportunity for all of us when we can work with the unions to get those who have been historically not allowed to be part of this entree into this great, great work. So we're excited about that. Our next step is to go to a hybrid model. Again, we have six in-house crews, but we're going to also go to contracting with some weatherization contractors to help us get our work done. The last couple of weeks we have been training with Thor, and Thor I believe to be the largest minority construction company in the country, and they just happen to be located in Minneapolis and Minnesota. And so we have been training their two crews from their operation, and in the next week or so they will begin to help us with our efforts to weatherize 1,700 homes. In addition to that, and I'll be done, we have created 16 jobs, and these jobs include staff supervisors, job costers, weatherization laborers, schedulers, and the like. And I am delighted to tell you that of those that we have, that new jobs that we have created, and feel that 25% of those are either women or minorities of color. So I'll stand for questions after my colleagues have completed.
Thank you. Mr. Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bill Davis, and I serve as the President and CEO of Community Action Minneapolis. We've been insulating houses in the city of Minneapolis for almost three decades. We've weatherized close to 10,000 to 15,000 homes on that period of time, so we clearly are not strangers to this activity. We also look forward to continuing this work in years to come. As a result of our efforts, we, and I know the chair and other committee members were interested in some of the demographic, social demographic information. Mr. Hightower shared some of those on from his agency, I like to do a similar profile. We had 150 contractors attend our initial meeting, express interest in working in our programs. Out of that, 62 of them were actually certified by our organization as being eligible to provide this type of work. Unlike the previous presenter, we elect, or we have gone the route of having vendors or contractors do our work as opposed to having them in-house for a number of different reasons. But out of those 62 people that we had certified, 20 of them were small-sized companies, 21 were large companies, 13 were minority-owned, and 8 of them were owned by women. As a result of our efforts, we've been able to place 19 crews with an expectation of going hiring as many as 25 crews to perform the work that we have set aside to complete. Out of those weatherization crews, we've employed indirectly 37 people to, with those 19 crews, that represents 37 people. Among them, we have two African Americans, 6 Latinos, 1 Asian American, and 2 women serving in our weatherization component. In our mechanicals, which is also another very important job area, we've hired, and that's the furnace replacements and the other kinds of HVAC work that goes on with this weatherization contract. We've hired 4 African Americans, 7 Latinos, and 3 women in the mechanical end of things for a staff complement of about a total of 89 people are going to be employed conducting the work that we have to provide in the city of Minneapolis. I think it suffices to say that we feel very good about where we are. We certainly anticipate meeting all of our goals. We also want to continue having the pathway cleared in terms of all the regulations. We have a number of regulations and a number of rules that have been promulgated not only by this body but also at the federal level that makes the job a little bit more cumbersome, but it's still doable, and we're very excited about this opportunity. We look forward to continuing to weatherize homes in Minneapolis. I don't want to cite our exact numbers of completion right now because I don't have those available in front of me, but we're similar to where our counterpart is in St. Paul in terms of completion, and we look forward to working with this committee and meeting some of the other goals and objectives that you've already outlined during your presentations and during the hearing this morning. So thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you very much, Mr. Davis. Welcome to the committee. Mr.
Bennett, sorry.
Yes,
yeah. Sorry. Madam Chair, committee members, I could certainly talk about, as my peers did, about the way things are, but I think Arnie asked me here to talk a little bit about the way things will be, and give a small highlight of something that we're really excited to be involved in. A pre-application was sent to NCAP and Axon in a national competition, and we were invited to provide a full application. So we're pretty confident that we're gonna come through here. And it is around providing training in rural areas for installation of solar energy. We have put together a proposal in partnership with Otter Tail Wadena, which is another Minnesota community action, Rural Renewable Energy Alliance, Southern Indiana Renewable Network, and Decent Energy in Kansas City. And the goal is to provide training to 300 installers of solar heat, solar air, solar water, and photovoltaic. And we intend on using low-income homes as the labs or where the classrooms will be. So when this is all said and done, 24 low-income households will have either solar heat, solar water, and the 4 facilities that are involved will have photovoltaic. energy usage. The model should train about 150 installers in rural Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Bennett. And Mr. Tardy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Harlan Tardy. I'm from the Arrowhead region. Our agency is the Arrowhead Economic Opportunity Agency, and I'm here because we do it a little differently on the range, as some of you might know. I see my senator and representative are not here at this time, but I assure you they already know what I was going to say anyway. In our area, service area, have all of our staff in-house. We've had them there from the get-go, right from the beginning of the weatherization programs. And they're all steelworkers. All of our staff belong to steelworkers, and we hired 48 staff. Our area serves the city of Duluth and the rest of St. Louis County, up the North Shore, Lake and Cook counties, and additionally we also do Grand Portage Reservation as well as Fond du Lac. We have a very large mix there. We have similar numbers to both of my colleagues next to me in terms of numbers of houses to complete. We currently have completed 209 homes as of yesterday. We have 62 that are being worked on as we speak, so I suspect within a week or thereabouts we'll be moving forward. So I share the same confidence that Mr. Davis does, is that we are well into this activity. We're well on our way to getting the numbers that we promised you back during the hearing. We're committed to get that done. Some of the things that happened in our area is that happened in our application process. High unemployment across the range, as most of you know. We had nearly 300 applications for these 48 jobs. They came from all walks of life. Some of them were very skilled. They came from the very contractors that the people talked about earlier who are now out of business and were looking for jobs. We ran from there. We did go very exclusively out into the targeted groups to seek applications into that group. We too will be able to, in the January meeting, give you the demographics of where all those people came from in terms of their makeup. We'll provide you that as well. But we have I have an example of what's happening in our area, and I suspect it's happening across the state. Through our energy assistance application process, our numbers have just skyrocketed. We this year have got 5,300 certified applications to date for this year. Last year at this time, 1,709. And that's certified. Those are eligible applications that are in the process that are eligible to receive energy assistance, which we then now can draw from. I'm here to tell you that a very significant number of those are seniors. And we have seen this as opportunity to do some of the things that Mr. Kalin asked about earlier, and that is to how do we get them introduced to other services. Many of these are first-time people in our services, and we have got the opportunity to talk to them about Meals on Wheels. We've gotten to talk to them about senior insurance advocacy and how to, the confusion that they're facing with their insurance plans. We're also, besides opportunities for energy assistance and weatherization, they're getting opportunities to talk to them about their tax services and all kinds of things that the CAP agency is able to provide to them. And so they're getting a lot of other opportunities once they, are in our system. And so the outreach there is working. It is kind of scary to see how many of those numbers are increasing, though. And I suspect we are, in our agency, Early projections were that we were going to have in excess of 10,000 applications. I'm afraid it's going to exceed that tremendously this year. So that was an example of how things are working in our area. The applicants themselves, but going back to that one note, we are seeing very, very high-skilled applicants, and which we have to try and do a balance, at least in our area, to bringing in those new and apprentice types activities and measure that against the high skill that is there available. So it's making our job real tough because we have a lot of high unemployment, young good workers with skills, with families, and we're having to have to choose between that and do we bring in the others. So there is that other side of the coin. It's making it very difficult for us with the high unemployment to do everything that you're hoping for. So we apologize for that, but we wish there was more money, too.
Well, thank you, all of you. I have a couple questions, and then there's some members of the questions. Mr. Tardy, I'll start with you because you ended, and thank you for commenting on the apprenticeship issue. And I guess the one, and I understand what you're saying, it's hard when there's more people who are highly skilled. It's hard to choose among them and choose to hire new people who don't have those skills. But you're aware, I mean, obviously you could save some money if you use some apprentices. So is that a way to sort of stretch your dollars a little bit further?
Yes, that certainly is one way to be able to stretch those dollars. But the other side of the coin, in a good way, is that the people we've hired are all getting the Davis Bacon wage, and they're all getting that wage and fringe structure that is in that. We did explore very, very extensively what we call the work experience activity, where we had hoped that we could have our crew structure set and then add, and the union agreed to it, our steelworkers agreed to it, where we could have someone that worked the ground that was mentioned earlier, lesser skills and all of those, but they too would have to be paid at the Davis Bacon unless they're in an approved apprenticeship, and we're exploring the apprenticeship as we speak to try and do some other things with that, but we would have a hard time with our particular union putting these work experience folks in at the same ways as the entry level and the others. So we're balancing that. We're working on that. The apprenticeship is obviously the only route that can fix that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And I appreciate hearing from all of you how hard you're working to try to really ramp up quickly when the times require you to do so much. Not just the money requires it, but or creates that opportunity, but the number of people looking for your help is just, it sounds really overwhelming. Just two more things I wanted to say, and then I'll ask for members and apologize, but first, I have to say to Mr. Hightower, thank you for your fantastic work in my county. I'm really proud of Ramsey, Washington, and it's great to hear you mentioned as a role model and as setting a high bar for what you do. So thank you. I just want to say that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And also, Mr. Bennis, I'm really excited to hear about what you're doing with the solar heating project. And we put that in the bill, too, and we were really wanted to see some results there, so I'm very excited to hear that. I guess I just wanted to ask Mr. Davis and Mr. Bennis if you could comment on the use of apprenticeships and or training opportunities for your workers. I'm not sure. Mr. Davis, maybe you mentioned that, but I missed it.
Madam Chair, let me, I perhaps glossed over it, but let me just reiterate that. Because we have the luxury of, or use the model of contractors, we have a blend of union contractors. Several of our contractors are union. Several of them have utilized the hire interns or apprentices out of the hire training program. and the others are a hodgepodge of all the above. So we can sort of tinker with ours a little bit to make sure we have a good blend of people so that we're doing the kinds of things that not only are job creation, but also affording individuals that are disadvantaged, hard-to-employ individuals, a skill and an opportunity to be employed. So that's one of the luxuries we have by not being exclusive one way or the other, but having that flexibility of hiring our own contractors and then asking those contractors with a little bit of a persuasion to go after having the choice of going with union route or going with the higher route.
Thank you. And Mr. Bennett, anything you
want to
add?
Madam Chair, I could list a lot of luxuries that we don't enroll in. But anyway, we use an in-house model because we've had crews as long as I've been associated with Lakes and Pines, which goes back a quarter of a decade. And we are at this point not utilizing an official apprenticeship model. But we have a self-created one somewhat. And when we knew that there was a ramp-up that was going to be required, we split our crews and then hired in, and then split them again and hired in, and training those new people. In terms of our positions, we have crew leads and crew workers. And after a level of training, those crew workers become crew leads, and then in our current situation, they become trainers of new people that come on. I can also speak a little bit to the same dilemma that Harlan has in terms of applications. Our initial openings were for auditors because we knew we'd have to audit jobs to start out with, and we opened with two and had over 200 applications for the two positions. And so in terms of qualifications and people looking for work, we have to, again, struggle with a balance between taking some very qualified people, which are going to get a lot of work done in a short amount of time, and those people that might just be entering the job market or just have lower level of skill.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try not to stand between us and lunch. My good friend, Mr. Bennis, who does really, really good work, he had a lot of headaches given the very diverse mix we have in our region. Thank you for doing your work. I want to save you another headache. The solar heat and those pieces are phenomenal. They're really exciting. I think the grant is really exciting for that, for those reasons. Glad to see that it's happening in our region because it's a perfect fit. On the solar PV side, there are some folks sitting to your right in the audience that will come and talk to you afterward who have experienced a lot of the same struggles. I know that they're probably, I think I saw their hackles go up at the same time that mine did about the grant. So we will want to make sure that you guys connect and talk about the lessons on the ground dealing with licensure. Sort of, we can all hear more about the licensure issue in the state electrician piece, as well as we want to make sure that we're not also spending public dollars to create training programs that already exist through the private sector, which I want to just remind us all that IDEW and others are doing this training work on their own dime with no public dollars involved. So I just want to make sure we're not going to answer it now, but I wanted to lay the groundwork so you guys have a chance to connect, to work through these issues. We've also had that frustration with Minsky. And we're in the process of, getting positive places with it, and so we don't want to have to do this again and again. But again, on the solar heat side and hot water, it's exciting, great work. Representative Taylor's been a fantastic champion here. It's one of the reasons it's in the bill, and it's great to see you following up on it. So thank you.
Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first of all, I'd like to reiterate many of the comments that Senator Anderson made relative to Ramsey County work and the solar work. I have a question here from Senator Torres Ray, who could not stay, and she apologizes. I was appreciated that in your comments you said that in January we will have full demographic information. She's getting a lot of phone calls that have some questions about whether all of the communities of color being represented. And so she's looking for community by community numbers.
Mr. Cardin?
Madam Chair, I did mention that we're doing two of the reservations. I assure you we're hiring from their populations for those, and so ours will be representative, I assure you that.
She's asking also about Southeast Asians and Latinos. And
thank you. Any other questions? If not, thank you. Thank you for your patience in this long hearing, but it's been incredibly valuable, and we appreciate all of your work. Thank you all for being here. The meeting is adjourned.